This meeting is now being recorded.
Shall we start? Okay, everyone, thank you. Welcome back. Why am I getting an echo? Not me. Is it me? Let's see. How about now? Is someone trying to enter the Adobe Connect room as Kay? Okay, we'll let you in. There is an echo. Hang on. Seriously. Let's see. Okay, I'm just going to start and hopefully it'll get cleared up. This is going to get really difficult. Let me make sure it's not me. Is it me? It's in the. It's coming in from the speakers. It can try to speak. Are you going to be able to concentrate? Let's try this one. My fault. My degree is in communication studies, not technology. Okay, so with the 3 minutes remaining, a half-hour slot, the rest of the agenda for this afternoon was to spend about half hour going over the metrics we've collected to date. These are the metrics that were recommended by the IAG CCT and that we've been publishing. And then from there, we were going to break out into the two big sub-teams, the competition and choice and safeguards and trust. We have this room and another room reserved so those teams can break off. So I can run through this fairly quickly. Really what I wanted to achieve with this session was to give you an idea of what we have and where it is. And hopefully you can take that back to your teams and look at the data, what we're collecting, see if it's the right data, if there are further questions we need to be asking about that data. And then there's also a set of metrics that the IAG decided to leave up to the review team to decide how you wanted to collect. So I think it's sort of kind of two categories of metrics that each sub-team needs to look at and decide how they want to proceed with those, how you want to consider them. So I'll just quickly go through that. So as I said, there were 66 metrics that were recommended for collection. 28 of them are being published online at this URL I have here, and I'll share that page with you in just a minute. The 11 of them have been collected via the surveys that we talked about today with Nielsen, the consumer and registrant surveys. 3 are collected via the economic study. That's analysis group's work. And then 2 more, which we are not reporting on, but we will be able to. It was decided that these would really be captured by any work ICANN or other parties do on universal acceptance. It has to do with whether or not new G names are actually resolving in different software platforms, so on and so forth. So that leaves us with 22. That are in this realm of either data that comes with a cost, so traffic data would be one that falls under this category. Another one has to do with SLA levels. We initially thought we could report on the SLA reporting that our contracted parties do to us, but we can't publish those. So we're not quite sure how to tackle these. These are the first, I think it's 1.1 to 1.3 and 1.5 have to do with SLAs. And I believe those are in the trust categories, but that's a conversation we can have with the sub-team. And then there's two others I want to point out that kind of point in the direction of a qualitative analysis, and this is another place where we'll need to talk about resources. One is 1.11, which gets at the question of IP costs related to, as it's phrased in the metric, policing of new GTLD names. So the metric asks, it's long, you can read the whole thing, but it asks what kind of new costs are there for brands, how much are they expending to protect their names in new GTLDs. There's a series of questions in there that are pretty hard to answer unless we get some self-reporting from brand owners. Under this particular metric, we've had several conversations with INTA, the International Trademark Association. They're interested in working with us on this because obviously the findings here are of interest to their members. And they may even be willing to field a survey to their members. We're not quite sure yet. We've still had conversations with them. And again, this is something where maybe a few sub-team members can engage with INTA on that idea. But that's something for which there isn't exactly an existing data pool. We'd have to find it somehow, and there are a lot of considerations as to what data we get. You know, if it is coming from someone like INTA, that's an advocacy group. We have to consider that in the context of how good is this data or what are the parameters on the data that we're looking at. Another one is on 1.22, which has to do with question 18, the mission and purpose question. And this metric really got to the question of how well those applicants are meeting the obligations they said they would, or what they obliged themselves to do in terms of mission and purpose. And there's a lot of different ways we can do this. Another colleague of mine, Antonietta, has been working on a research proposal of one way we might be able to do this, and we can present that to the sub-team that's working that has this metric in their bucket. But that's another one to think about in a more it's kind of a little more complex than collecting just numbers, although I don't think any of these are just numbers. So with that in mind, those are sort of the two major categories of metrics. I thought I would go and scroll through what we have, what we've published so far, and as just sort of a guide so that you can see. I'm just going to share my screen. Nobody jabber me.
Alisa, can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
And it's a process question, and I guess it's for the group as well, in terms of transparency. Is sharing something with this group the equivalent of publishing it? I guess at my point, are we able to deal with confidential data as part of this and keep it confidential in the team?
Well, if I can answer that. So right now we've taken a very high level of transparency on this group. So the email lists are all open. These calls are, you know, they're open to observers. The only real thing that isn't happening is that observers can't interact with you while you're having your meetings. All the documents are on our wiki. So we can develop a process to address things that we don't want to be, in the public realm if it's something that's sensitive. But we haven't actually done that yet. And to the extent that we identify things that need to be, that you would like to look at that raise that level, then we'll have to explore how to do that and cognizant that everything is so transparent at the moment.
So two things, Margie. Thank you. I think when we were developing that policy about observers, we had some caveat in there, although we haven't gone into detail. We had some caveat in there about confidential discussions being the exception to that or something. So just a question of figuring out what that process would be in restricting conversations on the regular listserv, et cetera, about that. But I guess the – so that's – we can keep things confidential. When you said that the SLA data, for example, you weren't prepared to publish it, is that the same as you weren't prepared to share it with this group because of conflicts of interest in the group or something like that? So I just wanted to figure out, get some clarity on that.
No, thank you for pointing that out. What I meant was we can't just publish it on our website. And I, what I should have said is that we need to figure out a better way of getting the data to those who need to review it, but it's not published here on this page, although we have the data. So there's privacy, not privacy, I guess some confidentiality concerns around that. So that's what, more of what I was getting at. And as Margie said, we'll have to figure out ways to work through that. But the data exists.
This is Stan. Quick question. I take it we could publish, even the committee's report, could publish summary statistics that don't divulge individual companies' information.
Correct. It depends on in what instances, but yes. In general, yes. And that's what we've asked analysis group to do, and they're obviously in their reporting is at a high level. Okay. So this is our website. Anna is also here. Anna is the intern on our team, but she's so much more. And sadly, she won't be with us for very long. She was recently accepted to USC's PhD program, where she's going to be, she can tell you more about the details, but she's going to be studying internet governance in a lot more detail.
I have an idea for a dissertation topic. Really, I think we could formulate a good one right here in this room.
So credit where credit is due. Anna has done a lot of very heavy lifting in parsing many, many data sources to put a lot of this together, and she can answer a lot more detailed questions than I can, but I'm just going to give you a high-level overview of what we have here. So as I said, these are 28 of the 66 metrics that we've published. We broke them down into these categories: compliance, registries, registrars, registration, navigation, and RPMs, thinking this might be a more helpful way of looking at the different types of data sets we have. That being said, under each metric, you'll see here, we've noted which category the IAG has highlighted this particular metric for. So while this might go to the trust group, I'm sure the choice group may also be interested in this data, but this is just, there are lots of different ways to slice this. We thought this might be the most helpful way when considering some of the questions you'll be asking. So a lot of the data that is available on here is snapshots of what we have, or is a high-level summary of what we have. So going through here, notices of breach issued, that's pretty clear-cut. We know the numbers there. I'm going to try to find one that's a bit more complex. So, for example, we have a large data file that, what did we decide we're going to call it? The CCT master document, I think it's called, which Anna has put together, and it's really helpful. So it includes every new GTLD as they're delegated, what the string is in the local characters, as well as the UID, as well as the language script, who the registry operator is, where they're based, who the registry service provider is, so we can cut across all of these different categories and count them in different ways. So I don't know, is that up on this page yet?
No.
Okay. We're still working on finalizing that document. But that's a very large piece of work that will be available to you so that you can cut through these things yourself and slice the data in ways that might be helpful to you. So when you see something like this one, 2.4, which is TLDs using IDN scripts, it's nice that you can see that there are six that are Arabic language scripts, but you might want to know more about what those six are. Where are they based? Are they in the Middle East? Are they elsewhere? Do they use back-end providers? So on and so forth. We have... Yes.
For this, we have, okay. No, actually, for 2.4, we decided to, this is Anna, for the record, Anna Loop. For 2.4, it asked for IDN scripts. We decided to break it out into two different languages, or into languages and scripts. So we report on both language and script here, because if you're looking at, for instance, German, there are two German TLDs. They're in German. We scroll down. So, and those are technically, yeah, so the script type and the language are, it's important to note that there are some differences there.
Yeah, what? How are you counting German TLDs? Certainly, like Berlin, I would think would also be German, but it's not in your count, presumably.
Yeah, so it's not for these. So we're counting IDNs specifically. So it's
in the case of German, it would be TLDs, extended Latin character sets. Is that right?
Exactly, and we actually, if you scroll down a little bit, I think this is here, you'll see, and I don't say extended Latin script, so maybe I should put extended Latin script here, but you'll see the two that say Latin script, and then it'll say, it should be noted that the two German IDNs are counted. So, yeah, they're a lot more using the Latin script, obviously, than just two, but, yeah, we tried to make that differentiation there.
So like I said, there's lots of ways of looking at this data and how we count it. This is one way that we've done it so far. That's why I think it's really important that you look at the full data sources that we have, and that way you can slice it as you see fit. So I think I'll stop there with this page. You can scroll through. I'm sure there are a number of questions related to different metrics that are relevant to the sub-teams you're working on. And I think what we'll do when you break up now is Anna and I will split up, and we can answer those questions if you want to go through those with us. The other thing I wanted to highlight, and I will stop sharing here so I can do that, is a document I sent around about the remaining metrics for discussion. How the heck do I stop sharing? One second. There we go. Let me just pull this document up. It's the remaining metrics for discussion document, which I believe I emailed to everyone earlier. Come on. So these are the metrics I had mentioned earlier. What did I say? These are 22, I think, that we need to figure out how we can provide these to you. So the top four were the ones related to SLAs. Again, we have this data. It's a matter of figuring out how best to provide it and respect confidentiality agreements that ICANN may have. 1.11, that's the one I had mentioned about intellectual property claims and costs associated with that. Then there are others, like 1.14, quantity and relative incidence of domain takedowns. How do we collect that? You know, there's... do we ask registries directly for that? Who's going to report on that? And what do we consider a representative number? So there's a number that raise questions like that I think will be good for the sub-teams to discuss. Moving on, this next set of four has to do with DNS abuse, everyone's favorite term, abusive behavior, spam, phishing, botnets, malware. There's lots of external sources that track this type of behavior and activity. The question is who we want to rely on and what data you see as being relevant and most useful and how we want to define those terms. I'm sorry? Mm-hmm. And then there are some others where I think we need some more help from the team in defining terms. So 1.21 has to do with errors in new gTLD zones. We got into this discussion a little bit with the IAGCCT, but I think we still need some help refining this because there's a lot of – it's still left too much room in the definition to really help our team narrow down what they're measuring. This would be to our technical services team. So that's another one to think about. And then, I mean, I could go through all of them. 5.2 through 5.4 have to do with, Facebook uses social media, QR codes, URL shorteners. Again, data that exists, but the question is, where do we want to get it from? How much are we willing to spend on it? And what exactly do we want to prove with that data? What is the purpose of the data?
Jonathan, Xavier's discussion got a little bit tied up at the outset, and I think he never got to the point of discussing an actual budget. Is that something that we will try to?
I have that data. I can share it later. I'm just going to pull it up. And I think that's pretty much it. You can scroll through the document yourself, and I think you'll quickly see why why these questions were left to you. They're much harder questions to answer on where we get this data and how we want to frame the questions so we get the data that you want and that best represents what you're looking for. So that's kind of it. I'll keep it short just because I think we can answer more questions in the subteam, and I don't want to take time away from that effort. Any questions?
It's Megan Richards for the record. I had this question earlier because I didn't know what a QR code was. Sorry.
Squares. Like that. Which might be my new background. I think they're really popular in East Asia, but maybe haven't caught on as much in, I know, in the United States, except on airplane tickets. Can you use your mics, please? So that was all I wanted to present to you. There's obviously a lot more detail to what is there, but I don't need to explain every single metric. I'm happy to answer questions about individual ones, or we can use this time to break up into teams, and we can get into it more there.
So thanks a lot, Aliza. That's helpful. And, again, teams are going to get into these in some detail, with an eye toward determining both from that list and outside of it what additional research we want and especially that might lead to external costs. As a question for the group, as far as what we do next, we went through an extra brainstorming exercise about the application process review that involved kind of figuring out our verticals or our high-level themes or things like that. Is that worth doing together, or do you want to split up into teams and do that within the individual teams and kind of report that back? It's essentially codifying and supplementing what was done in the brainstorming session. Because that's just the question about, should we just divide up now and each get your page full of stickies, or do we want to try to coordinate that at all? Because we can obviously re-coordinate. We reassemble and report to each other and make comments to the other team. So it might be more efficient with smaller groups, that process, but I wanted to get feedback from the team and not be too authoritarian too early in the review process.
And we do have another room booked if we want to split up.
Actually, we have three additional conference
rooms. Can you use them, Mike?
Actually, we have three additional conference rooms booked. You could also use the space we just took the picture in upstairs. And then there is this room as well. We just ask that you don't leave the building and wander off because we know you'll go to the beach.
And also, because we have Collie and Calvin still on the line, we probably want this room to be used for and Drew for the sub-team that they want to participate in so they can listen. And I think that would be – do we have an idea which one that is? Competition?
Yes, it was competition.
I'm sorry.
Originally, Kylie, do you still want to be in competition and choice? Yes, I am in competition. He's already answered it. Drew? Drew is typing.
I think Drew wanted to be in the safeguards group.
He really wants to be a consumer trust.
You know what we could do, though? We could circulate a call-in number for him and do a conference call, right? I mean, one of our bridges. Yeah, Drew, why don't you put in your telephone number and we'll call you from a conference room because that way you can participate in the group that you would like to participate in.
It's Jonathan. Absent additional suggestions, I think we'll split up and make the first exercise to develop the high level themes like we did with the other thing and let the group organize and also select a leader. All right.
Did we decide who's in this room?
There's two groups, and we haven't. I don't think we've actually done the selection process yet. So I guess this is similar to the other one, but fewer categories. Who wants to be in the competition choice group? We might, yeah. And then I guess just to make it easy for Lisa to pick you out, can you raise your hand if you want to be in the trust and safeguards session? Pretty close to half, I guess.
Calvin, did you have a choice? For future reference, Calvin, we can put you in one of the groups now. Can you guys use the mics, please, so they can follow along?
Who are the two?
Who's missing from this meeting altogether?
Drew, Calvin, Kali, and Ravi. Ravi Shankar.
Okay.
He's typing right now.
He wasn't hearing all of that because our microphones were off.
Yes, Calvin, do you have a preference of whether you would like to be in competition and choice or safeguards and trust, even if you don't participate in the discussions today?
No preference. Okay. Yeah. Right. So, Calvin, thanks for being flexible. We'll let Robbie choose if he's got a strong preference and put you in the other group then, based on his choice. But feel free to fade now. Are we in the middle of his night or something like that? Okay, so who do you want where? Does it matter? Competition here, okay. And then...
And then the safeguards is going to go to... Spruce Goose, so it's just down the hall on the left, right before you get to the hallway for the restrooms.
We'll lead you there.
Excellent. The trust and safeguards folks are going to be going to Spruce Goose.
And then
the extra conference rooms available for David for sleeping rooms like on Singapore Airlines.
If we're not going to use them, I'd like to release them.
And the Spruce Goose.
We had on your agenda to start your wrap-up session at 3:45. Do you want to meet back in here then?
We're trying to start the wrap-up at 3:45?
Yeah, or we could start at 4. We just wanted to allow for a break at some point.
Before it or after it? I don't know.
Before. So after the sub-teams meet, maybe have a 15-minute break.
Okay, that makes sense. So maybe, does that mean that we take our break at 3:45?
At either 3:30 or 3:45, I would say, yeah.
Okay. Let's say 3:45.
Okay. And then we'll reconvene at 4 with the whole group.
Right.
Okay.
Okay, perfect. Break. The football term, sorry, American football term. Split up. So as far as, Elisa's at it again. As far as an outcome from this group, I think the first thing was forming it. The second thing is identifying a team leader chair. And then I think what would be a good, if folks agree, would be to go through the similar exercise we went through yesterday with these sort of through lines of discussion that came out of the brainstorming and add to that, et cetera. And then probably, I don't know. Those would all be good byproducts. I mean, hopefully an early deliverable, which isn't going to be today, but is maybe it's identifying a deadline for it, is to come up with additional research projects that we think would be useful to have, because obviously they'll need time to get done. So, and you were going to give us budget information too.
So we have this is for the fiscal year of 16. So this ends in June, and then we're doing the new budget cycle for after June. We have $381,000 for travel, and we have $250,000 for professional services. So that's till June, and then the nice thing is if we figure out what our resources are for the next part of the fiscal year, that we can get that request in. We have an amount that we've submitted to Xavier based on an average review team from using past history, but it's better to be more accurate based on what we want. So the sooner we can identify what additional resources we need in the next fiscal year, the better for us, so that I can get that request in.
And, sorry, Margie, do you guys have an expectation, a rough number in terms of between L.A. and Marrakesh, how much of the travel budget will be consumed?
So that number, $381,000, was for two face-to-face meetings and two ICANN meetings. So that was what we estimated for a total of four meetings before the end of June.
Right. So you're expecting that will cover Marrakesh, wherever we happen to end up in the summer, this meeting, and then one other face-to-face. Okay.
Yeah, that's our estimate.
And do we know, so the $250,000 for other stuff, that could be used, like if we identified additional research, is that the principal place you expect to spend that?
And yes.
Can you guys give us any sense of what the expenses associated with the analysis group and the Nielsen efforts are, so we know how to scope what that $250,000 means?
We have to take that request back. I believe that's confidential. I know that the implementation advisory group had made a recommendation on an amount. Remember that the spend, but we'd have to look at the contract and see if we're allowed to share that information.
It's Megan Richards for the record. I just wondered if you could give us an estimate of the kind of external funding that was required for the other, well, they're not all similar, they're all different, obviously, but let's say for the ATRT. And it seems to me, without knowing the details of what was done in the ATRTs and some of the other reviews, that in this case we need a lot more external data and objective information than one would have needed in those other reviews. So if that's your assessment too, does that mean that the amount we have is relatively more? Because you said that the estimate you've made is based on previous reviews. So my gut feeling is that probably in this case we might need more.
This is Jonathan. My inclination is for us to figure out what we would like, prioritize it, and fight for it, right? And so that prioritization may figure out where that line ends up being, but having an abstract discussion about whether we need more, probably.
I wasn't asking the staff to tell us whether we need more or less. I was asking that based on the studies that were done in previous reviews, what kind of external studies were done, just so we get an idea. We, of course, will decide and determine what we need for our group, but it gives us also a ballpark idea of what amounts required for such kinds of assessments. And so far as I understand, you're telling us that both the Nielsen study and the analysis group study are outside that 250,000. Exactly.
Right, that's not included in the 250 we're talking about. Karen has some more information.
Just on the overall budget, I have some money allocated in my research budget as well towards this effort. What we have in this fiscal year is mostly intended to, follow through on some of the metrics that we didn't start in case we wanted to do the, purchasing market data or traffic data or doing the qualitative analysis and that kind of thing. So that's $150K in FY16, and then I've allocated asked for the same amount for FY17 to cover any sort of ad hoc requests.
Yeah, this is Stan. Given the fact that the analysis group and Nielsen are already sort of started, it might be that if we think of some additional work that we have them do, it might make sense to augment their budgets that they don't, and it might be a more efficient thing than finding somebody outside. I have some ideas of what additional things I would like them to do, and that might be a more efficient way to accomplish some of the stuff since they're already familiar with the data and are fielding the surveys anyhow.
That's correct. You can certainly do that to the extent you see, areas that you want to explore. We could go back to them and say, get an additional statement of work for, to cover the analysis you'd like to see.
And that's right. And in the case of Nielsen, he already said that, for example, we could have a micro survey of people that would otherwise be rejected as part of the survey, and it would just cost some incremental amount.
No.
Discuss that as well. So I think this is a difficult conversation to have in the abstract, and we ought to be pie in the sky initially and then try to figure out what things cost to accomplish. I mean, the numbers that were bandied around by the IAG may not bear any resemblance to what was actually approved by the board or was the result of the contracting process where they were trying to find the best bid or something like that. But, I mean, those numbers were in the $500,000 to $750,000 range for those. They were both pairs of studies, right? But just to give you a level set for a really big, you know, something like a Who Is study is probably enormously expensive, whereas getting the data for on traffic, you know, is nowhere near that because it's getting data that's already been, right? So, I mean, that's the, it's going to run the gamut.
Well, just to follow up on what you said, it's Megan Richards. It's what I wanted to ask as well, and that is that it seems to me that there's a lot of extant data already as well that we could use. And so rather than starting a whole bunch of new assessments, aren't there some graduate students somewhere or other such people who could be given small contracts, for example, just an idea, to see what exists already, and we could use existing data. I mean, I've circulated a couple of things to you. That's based primarily on CCTLD assessments, but there's another one called the Cum Laude study. I mean, it seems to me, and I'm not at all an expert in what's available, but it seems to me that a lot of people spend time looking at these things. And perhaps if we look first at what exists, then we can decide what else and in addition we need. No?
Well, and again, I mean, I that's one, this is Jonathan again. I think if we look at what we have and then decide what we want, the first exercise would be to see how we might best go about getting it. It may already exist, be a slight variation on something that's already being done, maybe data that exists that we need to pay for, or maybe research that needs to happen, primary research. And so those things will fall into those buckets, and we'll end up with like a wish list. Sorry, whoever's on the phone. A wish list budget, and then we'll try to sync that up through prioritization with the budgets as they're currently set in place. I mean, it could very well be that the fiscal 2017 budget, we're trying to budget ahead or something like that for study because we're less likely to need these research projects later in the process than it is earlier. And so, again, some of these things just might be some kind of a tug of war with Xavier if we really get to a point where we really, really need something that breaks the budgets as they currently exist.
Can we see the analysis group work statement? I assume that's not confidential. That is what they've been tasked to do.
Chuck, I mean, it seems like that makes sense.
Yeah,
I
can pretty much guess because I know what they did last time, and I assume they're going to update that. But it will be helpful to see it to know whether if we're suggesting something it's within the scope or out of bounds.
So one just a tactical question, Margie. What, in order to have useful influence on the FY 2017 budget, when do we need to tell you what we need?
Sooner rather than later. I mean, like I said, we've already put in a request. I don't have the numbers on top. I don't know. I mean, it has to go through a formal process, including, you know, board approval sometime in July, I think. So, but the sooner, you know, it gets in, the better. I think is it already open for public comment or is it about ready to? I apologize. I don't know where we are in the budget cycle.
Well, this is Carolyn. The step in the cycle, and I don't think anything's been published yet, but typically there's like a framework version of it that's published. And then I think there's like consultation on that. Then once there's an actual like proposed FY17 budget, that goes for public comment. But let me find where the reference is to the actual description of that. And I'll
the CCTRT can just submit a public comment to the budget saying we need more money.
Yeah, but you don't. I mean, as long as we know, we'll communicate it as quickly as we can. And as I said, we have a placeholder amount already. I just dig it up.
Extraordinary. It seems like figuring this out is our first priority in any case, so hopefully we'll have that done shortly.
This is Jonathan. I guess at the very least, one of the byproducts of this afternoon's work should probably be setting some deadlines for figuring that out. So as a first order of business, would somebody like to self-identify as potential chair for this sub-team and run this discussion?
Sorry, sure. I'll put my name forward if no one else is super excited, but I'm also happy to step aside if Mark is saying.
Oh, yeah. It's all downhill from here. I know how this goes.
And I say this with a caveat that I need to step out for like 10 minutes at some point in the next hour, so I'll be a somewhat ineffective chair for at least my first session.
So much productivity during that.
But I certainly don't want first mover advantage. Like, if there's other people that are interested, certainly I won't be offended.
Is anyone else interested in chairing the competition and choice subteam?
So quiet.
All right. All those in favor of Jordan, say, are you volunteering?
No, I was just going to say, David Taylor here for the record. I'm very much in favor of Jordan doing it.
All right. In favor, say aye. Well, opposed, say nay. Okay, Jordan, you are now the chair of the competition and choice subteam. Maybe
right.
I'll go to the other room and promote the creation of a chair there as well. So take it away, Jordan.
It's Laureen. They already have it, yes.
They're on the ball. I feel like, all right, team, we have to work, pull together to catch up with the other team. We don't want to be outdone consistently. All right, so why don't we just spend a couple minutes, I think Jonathan had us on the right track, but figuring out what we want to get done today, and then I think one of those things should be a rough expectation about how we want to spend our time over the next couple of weeks. One quick question for Steph. Have we given thought to, we have a meeting cadence, in, maybe this is in the work plan, we have a meeting cadence for the whole CCTRT. Is there a meeting cadence already determined for the sub-teams?
It is up to you.
All right, so that will have to be on the agenda. So agenda items are, we want to go through this exercise of identifying key topics. We'll start a discussion about research. We'll talk about overall timing and milestones, including meeting cadence, and perhaps whether we need sub-teams. we'll find out. Are there other topics that people would like to spend some time on here today?
This is Jonathan for the record. Thank you, Chair. The only other thing that would be good, and that might not need to happen conclusively today, but on the meeting cadence for the overall team, there are going to be report-in times from the teams where in fact you would be chairing the main call in order to report back to the bigger group on and lead the conversation and the feedback on whatever the findings were of this group. So one of the, if not today, early things to figure out is what a broad schedule might be for how the work is divided and how it will get reported back to the group.
Yeah, we'll roll that into the overall timing and milestones discussion, so including reporting.
I could say something more appropriate for later. In Marrakesh, are you supposed to, there's a session, I believe, in which we're meeting, collectively meeting, or maybe you're meeting with a larger group. What are you expecting us to report then to the larger group? Like in 2 weeks.
That's right. I it's not yet completely determined, but it's mainly meant to be a time for them to provide feedback to us and to raise issues that they want to make sure that we're to give their version of this exercise here, essentially. So I'll probably just give a little overview of where we are, which won't be very far along, and then invite commentary that we can try to take on board in our two-day meeting afterward. No pressure on you at all.
Yeah, Jordan, David Taylor. I was going to say one of the things to look at, which is one I've raised before on this, is the competition aspects of community versus standard, whether applied for the same TLD, and ICANN's perceived wish that a community should take precedent over a standard, and what in reality we're seeing. So that ties in with the theme I've been talking about.
And David and Jordan, do you think that belongs here versus in the application and sort of allocation of TLD process?
I think it belongs in both because you've got the allocation part, but then you've got the competition part as well, but it's sitting in both.
Isn't sure.
It?
Okay.
I agree with that. In fact, I've been sort of looking at the list of all the new registrants and the number of registrants in each of them at a very macro level. But I think it'd be worthwhile looking down at which ones have been the least successful in terms of the number of registrants and how they break down into the various categories. And that I think will be a very interesting thing to do as we think about how that market is functioning.
All right. So it sounds like we're now veering into the what are the key topics we want to talk about discussion. So I'm going to take from that we don't have any other high-level agenda items for today's meeting. And why don't we jump over to the talking about our key topics. I think that same exercise we did yesterday for the application process will be probably a good place to start here.
Lisa will pull it up.
We don't have to limit ourselves to those, obviously, but that's a good seeding exercise, certainly.
Dan speaking. Maybe we should discuss a little bit about the days when we have calls for our sub-team.
Yeah, so that will be the third topic where we talk about overall timing.
And how often
we definitely will. Thanks, Dan. I don't have Jonathan's mellifluous voice to keep us entertained while we wait for this to come up. And I definitely don't have a singing voice that will keep anyone entertained. So yes, we're going to start with the thing, yes, the same process yesterday by which the staff has transcribed the post-its. This is not the one we want though.
We want to
come. I keep forgetting what group I'm in.
Okay, so yesterday we started off with the premise that we were going to ask questions, which I like the idea of doing again, but our questions all led with the, was the application process effective at? I don't know if I have a good lead-in phrase like that we want to use here, but what do we think about the idea of identifying high-level questions that we seek to answer and translating these things into questions. Jonathan?
Jonathan, you had the idea yesterday of actually going back to the AOC, and we could do the same thing. That's where the word effective came from. I think the word in the AOC is contributed to or enhanced or something, and so maybe we could do the same exercise.
Megan, can you pull out your annotated AOC again? All right, so that may be helpful.
I can read it to you if
you'd
like.
Or Lisa, Megan, it sounds like you can.
Or
Lisa's
if you already have it up, it's okay.
No, she's digging in her bag, so if you can read it, that would be great.
Okay, so I can ensure that as it contemplates, let me just pull this up. This might be easier. But,
oh, sorry. What would I hear? At the end of the day, we're going to have the metrics, isn't it? One side, I think we had the, was it the activities? What did we call them? We're going to have our metrics on which we're going to map the questions that we're going to create right now.
So I would think that the way forward would be we would identify the questions that we want to answer, and then for each of those, we would say what is the data that we need in order to try to answer this question.
Okay.
And so that will lead into our second topic, which are what are the data sources that we need in order to be effective, including ones that might not exist yet.
Right. Like one of the high-level topics, this is Jonathan, one of the high-level topics might be about defensive registrations, right? And so in other words, under choice, are people using the new domains for real purposes or just to keep other people from getting them? And there are some metrics that are already being collected that speak to that. But the survey that that Michael Graham has been talking about inside of INTA, et cetera, I don't know if you've been a part of those conversations, and I don't know where that left off. And you know, where they survey their members about the costs or something like that may come into play there. So that's an example of where there might be two parts to it. Here's the metrics they already have and where we might want additional information. So this is Jonathan again. So we don't know, for example, for sure the study's going to be done, but one of the possible studies was about IP owners sort of self-reporting what the new GTLD program has cost them. And so one organization, an advocacy organization, INTA, had agreed to do a survey. Michael Graham inside the IPC was spearheading that and he was on the IAG for a while. I just don't know where it ended, and David and I can take it as a to-do to check in on that. But there's this issue about whether or not we would treat it as too biased or something, which I think was one of the things that came up in the IPC. Should we bother with this if the review team is going to think that it's not legit? So we need to resolve that or help them craft it in such a way that we would find it more valuable or something. So that's just one of the conversations where there's some metrics already and some additional we might want to get.
Yeah, I think it's a good idea to find out where they are as early on. But I also think we can get some of these questions answered through the survey of the registrants. Like I have in mind a series of questions that could be asked of registrants that might actually get at that question as well.
Yep.
So I think some of them have actually been passed on to Nielsen. Am I correct, Elisa?
Yes, it will, although they're not at the registrant survey phase yet.
I understand.
Yeah, but they will. We'll take that
they
up.
They haven't read it yet, in other words. It was passed on, but they haven't read it.
I'm used to that. They were taken aback by it.
It's Jordan, and I'll take off my chair hat for the moment, espouse an opinion for the moment, which is I suspect that the registrant survey is going to hit a pretty different segment of registrants than an INTA survey would. I think it's good to understand both sort of a broad cross-sectional survey that the Nielsen survey would hit, but since the defense of registration concept, I think most people would think that would largely apply to brands as opposed to casual domain registrants. I think that's the INTA survey would seem more likely to be useful on that front. Although maybe we would also find that people that had .coms and casually, not for their maybe for their blog or something like that, they might also be registering defensively. That would be an interesting finding, I suppose.
Oh, Jordan, I think the defensive registrations were much more than just the brand, as we may find that out. But I'm just wondering, what is the question now from Jonathan has said?
Yeah, so now Wado, we're back to the AOC, and it looks like our charter is to examine the extent to which the introduction or expansion of GTLDs has prompted competition.
Promoted.
Sorry. So far away. I need new glasses already. Has promoted competition, consumer trust, and consumer choice. So for the purpose of our exercise, we would wonder whether it had promoted competition and consumer choice, leaving consumer trust to the other team. So the question is, you're suggesting, Jonathan, we could say, has the GTLD program or expansion of GTLDs been effective at promoting ... Because I think questions like defensive registrations probably would want to phrase that as a different question, I would imagine, which would be...
There's some opposite of that.
Sure.
Use in that construction, press registration, useful...
But we'd want to know both, I presume, right? Like we want to know both, has it encouraged fresh registrations, and also what's the cost been in terms of innocent brands being forced to register defensively?
I had in mind the following. Ask somebody who was already in .com and is now in a number of other domains and didn't give up .com, so that's for one question, factually, how often did that happen? And then of the people who have essentially duplicate registrations, we could ask them, did you do that to protect your brand, or did you do that because you thought there were additional benefits by being in more domains? I mean, I think to me that's the way to go about it. The first part is a factual question, what did you do? And then to the extent that we can ask it, why did you do it?
So Stan, this is Jonathan. I think it's a good idea. I think Jordan's point is that the sample size of people that were engaged in defensive registration will be much smaller than it would be if a survey of brand owners were just on their own were taken. So let's do both. But I think taking this all up a level, the first thing is just to come up with the big questions we want to answer, and then how to get them answered is the next step.
Correct. So that's what I suggest. I'm going to suggest we just start to phrase general questions without the lead-in, and then if we want later on, we could go back and try to formulate them in a consistent manner. So let's just start with the list. So the first is, if competition is not founded on price, what services should be identified for competition? So that is a question unto itself. Is that one of the headline questions that we want to try to answer as a team? I think that seems a little specific, but does that roll up into some broader headline question we'd like to ask?
Well, I mean, this is Jonathan. Has been effective in promoting non-price competition in products and services from or something like that, and maybe it's from registries, or maybe there's a version of it or something like that. But that might be the high level question.
I like that question as Jonathan's phrased it. So at promoting non-price competition between TLD operators, is that or do we want to include other actors as well?
We want to include other actors. The question is whether we want them all munged into one question or actually have three versions of this question that have different actors. I don't know.
So Kylie noted in the chat that this was his point. Kylie, you want to type in what you think the question ought to be?
Or you can talk.
Or you can talk if you have bridge accents. We'd love to hear your voice.
Remember, this isn't a question of clarity. This is a group discussion about how to take this up a level of specificity so that others might be grouped under it that we find.
Then may I make a suggestion, but maybe it's not exactly the way you want it. Why don't you divide into price competition, non-price competition? Those are the two big issues, aren't they? And then you can determine what goes under price competition and what goes under non-price competition. Under non-price competition, you can have things like extra services, I don't know, da, da, da. And on price competition, you have price, obviously, but you have...
Wholesale, retail, secondary market.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. So maybe we just start off with two core questions here, which is, has the expansion of GTLDs been effective at promoting price competition? And then we can group some set of sub-questions under that, and then we'll have the non-price... I actually think either or both. Stan?
Yeah, by the way, non-price competition could also include a wider variety of domains in which to register. So it doesn't have to be, it's not limited to auxiliary services.
No, indeed, but I was using services as one.
No, I understand. I just want to say it's not limited to that. So one effect might be there are a lot wider variety of domains in which register,
right.
And that's a form of non-price competition.
So, Stan, I'm tempted to ask how we would determine whether that, like, does the very existence of the TLDs therefore imply that there's more competition? But why don't we wait till we get to the next question, which is how do we start to answer each of these big questions before I actually ask that?
Just to anticipate. I mean, what we're dealing with is really a very hard problem here, which is how to define the market, okay? And is the market, just stick with registries for a moment, is it the market for domain names? The Department of Justice, when they looked at this in 2004, thought each domain was a market, okay, a separate market. So there is this sort of question. And by the way, in the analysis group study, they grouped certain collections of domains that looked similar and said, suppose they are a market. What does the distribution of shares look like? So market definition is really hard. You're suggesting, and I don't think we're not going to certainly answer it today. We probably won't answer it at the end. I think at the end of the day what we're going to do is we'll say things like, if this is the way you define the market, here's the nature of competition in it. And you might get different answers depending on how narrowly or broadly you define the market.
This is Jonathan. I think furthermore, we'll end up creating market segments and looking at them individually so that the, you know, the, so that things like .cat or something like that, I mean, so the things that have a small number of registrations, so there may be market and then an S in parentheses, you know, how should we segment, define and segment the market or something like that.
Yeah. So, go ahead, Sam.
Just to give some examples, this is the analysis group study, and so they have dot bargains, dot cheap, dot deals, dot discount, dot gratis, dot coupon, I guess. And they thought of that as a, you know, a prospective market definition, and they looked at the shares, a perfectly reasonable thing to do.
All right, so this actually leads us, it's a perfect segue into the very next bullet point in our Post-it collection. I think there's, because this is a market definition question, it seems like, which is as more and more apps go directly to service providers, e.g. Facebook, the impact to the market for domain names and implications. So do we want to actually have a question that we're trying to answer that is specifically a what's the market question, Megan?
Well, I wasn't going to answer the what's the market question, but I was going to suggest something like, are new technologies and new mechanisms and new systems having an impact on the new GTLD market? Because that's really what you're asking there. Theoretically, there's a market for legacy GTLDs, new GTLDs, et cetera, but there are also other new factors that are coming in which are perhaps changing or impacting the market, which could be the reason that, I mean, this is an assumption now, a hypothetical assumption, that even though the introduction of new GTLDs was supposed to increase competition, these other factors have had such an impact that the new GTLD introduction has not been as successful in increasing competition because of these other factors.
So I've got Stan, then Wado. Okay.
I'm sorry. A slightly different way to say that is that the nature of competition among GTLDs is affected by these other external. So you might say if suddenly someone invented search engines, it would have a very different – it would imply something about the nature of competition among TLDs. And so I think you're absolutely right. It broadens the thing beyond the question of do TLDs just compete, but what's the environment in which they compete?
All right. Wado?
No, I was just agreeing with Wado here. I think it's important that you identify those factors that can impact on the competitive nature of the new TLDs. They are the external factors, the ones that might make those the introduction not to bring about more competition.
Jonathan.
This is Jonathan. One analogy I think that you probably dealt with your work at the FCC is that when they're looking at antitrust, like a merger between two cable companies, for example, and they define the market as cable television, then it'll get one answer, but if they define it as on-demand, video entertainment, then that includes, you know, people that are getting their internet via Fios or something that are not cable companies, and that's sort of the analog to this question. And that's why I try when we were coming up with this definition to say internet identity or something like that as a potential market, even though we may end up agreeing that it's too big for us to deal with or that it's outside ICANN's purview to manage it, to try and influence that market, et cetera, but that may be the broad market we're starting from and then trying to segment down from that or something like that.
Stan, do you want to say anything else?
Another example would be if you do include Netflix in analyzing the table system merger. But, yeah, I think we'll want to say something about these other factors. We may not be definitive about them, and we may not have the kind of data about them that we'll have about the domain name competition. But so, I think it's worth it. I think we should say something about it.
So it seems like we have a question here which is roughly like what is the market that we're considering? And then there's this question. And this question actually goes in two ways. Number one is like what are these extrinsic factors that are potentially affecting competition within the market that we define? And then also if that market may include things other than domain names, and then what's the effect of the introduction of these domain names upon that marketplace. So it's all, there's interactions in both directions. So these things, you know, Facebook could make it less likely, you know, or search engines could make it less likely that people need to use domain names, or it could be that, you know, there are search engines and we get these new domain names and everyone, no one needs to search anymore. That would be terrible.
So Kali has some questions. You might want to look in the chat.
Sure, thanks. And Kali has said, or maybe we can include a more fundamental question. What is the goal of competition? Why do we want it? Then we measure the competition according to price and other factors. And then we can look into whether competition is feasible in the industry and the market. So do we want to try to answer that foundational question of why do we want competition? Megan is saying no. Any other?
Sure. Go ahead. Why. Well, it's an interesting question, of course, as a fundamental principle. But I think under the affirmation of commitments, we are presumed to be looking at promotion of competition. So the argument of whether competition is good or bad is almost irrelevant. Of course, it's not irrelevant entirely. But in theory, to our purposes, it's almost irrelevant. So we have to presume that competition is good, and we have to go ahead and look at what the impact is. If someone else says it's bad afterwards, that's another issue.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree for that. For the purpose of keeping the scope of our exercise reasonable, we've been chartered to look at whether or not there is competition, not whether or not competition is awesome or not.
This is Jonathan. We may end up asking whether it was worth it. So when we look at defensive registrations or something, or costs there, or something that we may end up finding that there was an increase in competition, but there was such a big downside in trust or consumer confusion or something like that that may have outweighed the benefits. So we may end up asking that question indirectly, but we do know that we have to determine whether there's competition in each case.
Yeah, we're asking the question not metaphysically or not Marxism versus capitalism, but we're asking it whether or not in this particular case the benefits of competition outweighed the costs of the program, which seems like a reasonable exercise. So I'm conscious of time. We only have 50. No, I guess we have an hour and 8 more minutes, but we have quite a bit to get through. So I'm going to try to. Oops, I was going to say push us through this list, but it disappeared. But in any case, so it seems like we have a market definition question. So what is? Do we want to go with something as broad as what is the market that we are considering? Or Stan, do you want to help us with a better question than that?
My prediction is that we will not settle, and we probably should not settle, on a single market definition for the purpose of this project. It's just going to be too hard and too controversial. I think I would favor us keeping our options open and considering a number of possible market definitions, alternative market definitions, and analyze sort of competition within each of them. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just too early today to decide it.
Sure. So maybe the question and I'm not proposing we try to answer any of these questions today. I'm just trying to enumerate the questions that we're interested in answering in the coming months. And it seems like maybe a question is then what are reasonable definitions of competition that we might use?
Markets
that we might use to evaluate competition. Does that sound good? Did you get that, Lisa?
I'm trying to get Kylie on the bridge. Can you say that again?
So I think it is, what are reasonable definitions of markets that we might use to evaluate competition?
Just a minor modification. Antitrust guys would say relevant markets.
Sure. All right. Reasonable definitions of relevant markets.
Relevant antitrust.
Or market segment.
All right, so then how do we incorporate this as more and more apps go directly to service providers, the impacts? So maybe we just put this as a sub-bullet, like impact of non-domain identifiers. Does that make sense? So the next bullet, the question that the post-it that raised this discussion was the one right below, which is, as more and more apps go directly to service providers, the impact to the market for domains and implications. Should we just summarize that as saying, as we look at the definition of relevant markets, we want to consider non-domain identifiers?
Dodo here. I think it, that relates to the what she mentioned a little while ago about the impact of new technologies.
So maybe there's a separate question that I'm fine. I think we should have a separate question. That's not a market question, right? So then it's what is the impact on new technologies on competition in the on competition in the relevant markets that we will eventually define.
No. I don't think it's the impact of the new technologies. It's the impact of the new technologies on, I don't know how to put it, on the impact of the new GTLDs. The new GTLDs have an impact on the on competition, but it's also affected by the new technologies.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's a two-way.
Yeah.
It's a two-way
street. There's a way in which it can be put.
Go ahead, Sam.
Two things going on. One of the, you can think of these as exogenous forces that are affecting competition. That's like somebody invented search engines. But there's also the other direction, which is, I might predict, with many more domains, guessing would be less effective, and people might use search engines more often. And that's going to have to affect. So that's your two-way direction.
So I'm going to propose we have we do two things here. Number one is under the reasonable definition of markets, like I said before, we have a thing that's flagged that we need to consider non-domain identifiers or navigation. And then there's a separate question, which is what is the effect of these exogenous, that's a good word, these exogenous influences of new technologies on our competition. Does that make sense, Aliza? So that second one is a new big bullet, not a sub bullet to the market question.
Do you mean this one?
Yes,
that's
right.
A new big bullet.
Yes.
Okay, and then.
Correct. Yeah.
This
and hopefully now we've captured that question.
That was captured up here, right?
Well, it's captured in both, right? Like we've decided it has influences in both directions. All right, so then the next question is, can you, at least just to keep me saying, can you put a line break between the things that we've decided on and the things that are just posted?
Oh, yes.
All right, so measuring innovation. Oh, go ahead, Lada.
I still have a problem with that last one that we put there because we're not really looking at the effect of exogenous influences of new technologies on competition. We're looking at there's a way I think we should put it on the effect on the effect of new
GTLDs. So why don't we say on the introduction of new GTLDs? And that'll actually scope our exercise better anyways to what we're supposed to be looking at. So we replace competition with the introduction of new GTLDs. That does stand in line. So I'm going to suggest, just in the interest of time, we don't need to get the words exactly right here, right? So the idea is that we're going to look and say, there's new technologies. They're going to have some effect on the behavior of people, in the market. And we'll figure out exactly how to wordsmith this stuff later on. All right. So the next one then is measuring innovation, and we had quite a discussion about this. Yesterday. It's unclear to me, based on that discussion, whether we actually want to pose a question around measuring innovation or not. To people, I'll open this up for discussion, starting with Lago.
Yeah, Chair, I'm of the opinion that innovation cannot be measured, but we can measure its effects.
All right. So thanks, Lago. Any other opinions on this? Jamie's not here to argue on behalf of innovation. Yeah, so I'm inclined to agree with Lado. I would say we don't innovation will weave through our investigation into these other questions, but we we don't try to answer it as a standalone question. For example, as we look at non-price competition, I imagine a lot of what we'll be looking at there would be what a lot of people would refer to as innovation. All right, so let's drop that one. So now we have our first consumer choice question as opposed to competition question, which is choice or confusion. That's a pithy question that we could just leave. Or we could try to reformulate it. Do you like it as it stands, or?
As the introduction of new GTLDs brought more choice, more confusion than choice, for example.
Dan's claiming the topic and wants to talk. So go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, Dan speaking. The question is, did the potential registrants learn so far that they have that big choice of domain to register? Yeah, that was my thing that I was think about it. Are they confused with such a big amount of new domains, or are they aware that they have a big choice? Potential registrants. Registrants. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I thought this was about consumers. And one way to interpret this is, well, the really good thing about the introduction of new domains is it gave consumers a much wider array of choice. No, it's registrants. Right.
So.
But our definition
includes both.
Consumers are by definition internet users. I know.
Yes, there's more choice, but also potentially more confusion.
Right. I think Stan makes a good point. It is impossible, both of these things. I mean, probably as David just said, it's inevitable, right? Like, it is very – you're not confused at all when there's only black telephones to buy, right? But that doesn't mean it's – or black Model Fords, but Model Fords, Model T Fords. That doesn't necessarily mean that's good, and you know, maybe once there's more choices and you could buy a Model A instead, that is confusing. You have to think about the difference between the two, but it's added choice and confusion at the same time.
For most kinds of markets, we would say more choices is an unmitigated good. It's just actually more confusing here. Not so obviously an improvement, right?
So maybe the way to approach it, go ahead, David, before I...
No, I was just going to add to that, because it was one of the things when I used to talk on this years ago, in 2008, when the process was kicking off, I was used to use the example of, you know, today you may go to hotels.com to look for a hotel if you're going to New York City. Tomorrow you may go to hotel.nyc, or you may go to nyc.hotel, or you may go to nyc.hotels, or you may go to et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, or you may just go to Google. And then we'd say, and the only way we'll know is to see whether Google apply. But that was basically, you know, where's the confusion? So it's inevitable.
So I have a proposed path forward on this question, which is maybe we should just ask, has the increase in choice, has the benefits of the increase in choice outweighed the cost of potential confusion raised by the introduction of new GTLDs? The potential confusion, the cost of confusion.
And at least one of the two kinds of cost. The other one is the cost of defense and registration.
Correct, and we'll get to that in a minute. Yeah.
About things that might offset what ordinarily you would think of the benefits of it. Or
hello, just a try. Do you anybody hear me?
Is this Kylie?
Hello.
Yes, Kylie. Is that you?
Yeah. Okay. Great. Okay.
Excellent.
No,
welcome,
I'm
Kylie.
On the phone. Great. Thank you. Yeah.
Is you're very dim. Can we do anything about volume? All right.
All
right. This is the part where I have to be a terrible chair. I have to duck out for about 10 minutes. Can I? Can we have a vice chair or temporary? Can someone hold the gavel for a few minutes or take a? Pardon? I should be here. So should we have a? Should we front load our 10 minute break into now? All right. So let's 10 minute break. Let's reconvene at 3 o'clock. Thank you.
So I will. Hand on to my phone, right?
Say that again, Kylie.
Well, I'll still just hand on to my phone, right?
If you don't mind, if you can hang on for 10 minutes, we'll be back.
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah, for me. Otherwise, yeah.
Okay. You can also put your comment in the chat if you can't stay on the line.
Well, I'll stay on the line.
Thank you.
we're going to restart. Do we still have Kylie on the line?
Hello? Hello?
Well, he's now capable of speaking with us. Oh, we hear his quiet voice.
Yeah.
Did we see something typed in?
Hello? Yeah. Hear me?
We can hear you, Kylie. You're just a bit faint.
Yeah.
We will all get very quiet when... Oh.
Okay, yeah. So we have started again.
Yeah, so Kylie, we're thanks for joining us on the phone. We will yell loud or something when you want to talk, and we'll all shut up because it's very quiet and hard to hear you otherwise.
Thank you. Well, so maybe if I want to talk, I raise my hand.
Sure, that sounds great.
Yeah, okay. That's the usual protocol, okay?
Yeah.
Please go ahead.
Thanks, Kylie. All right, and Aliza, can you move that the question we just decided on up to the questions we've agreed as opposed to down in the...
Yes, although it's not a complete question because I think I lost the thread toward the end.
So I'm not... we'll reword Smith all these later. The cost of confusion. I don't know. Let's wordsmith it later. We only have 39 minutes now, so I want to run through these relatively quickly. So we asked community versus standard versus brand. This is David. Go ahead, David.
Yeah, it's David Taylor for the record. This is really the competition between registry operators, so whether a community, a standard, and a brand, and how those are interacting, especially if they're applied for the same TLD. So I suppose really maybe there's two sub-points here, I was thinking, because this is really a competition between registry operators, and then we've got a sub-point being community versus standard versus brand, and then a second sub-point, which would be something like single TLD versus portfolio registry. Again, there, where they're applying for the same TLD or a similar TLD, and there we've got the competition aspects.
This
is just, I think, another version of the market definition.
Yeah, it's where we were discussing on the terms of reference, and we were coming in now.
That because you're asking in a sense, the community TLDs compete with.
Well, there's a slightly different question that I don't know if you're trying to get at or not, David. So we don't necessarily have to add it if you're not. But is a community TLD sort of more effective at competing against other TLDs than a non-community TLD, or where would a brand be better at it? That's different from the market definition question. It's like, do these things have advantages, or have they been more effective in the marketplace, or something like that?
Yeah, and I think it is a different point, but I think it also comes down to the fairness. And again, I'd come back to the thing with ICANN always saying that at the beginning it was the communities were the ones in a way that were backed better, and if you reached that high score, and you got your community status, you had a joker status. And at the beginning, we had brands wanting to be communities. We advised many, many brands on that that were coming through. So, well, we're a community. Here's why we're a community. We have our community of users. We have our community of this. We want the community status because then we trump a standard application. So it was a big thing. And that, to me, is the point there. When you've got today community applicants, standard applicants, and brands in the same market, you're coming at them from very different angles. A brand has a lot of money. A community is a small community, which might be from Africa, which might be from somewhere else, which has applied for the same TLD but doesn't have the same leverage or competitive effect. So that's really the point coming to. And then the same on the single TLD or the multiple portfolio applicants. Again, you've got a difference in leverage. So I think that's an aspect to look at.
So the applied for the same TLD question is one for the application process discussion, because we're looking at effects in the marketplace after they're already in the market. But nonetheless, I think I like more Stan's question than my question. So I think I'd propose moving this up into the market definition.
But I actually have another version of this. It's a factual question. Economists are used to looking at successful firms as one that have large market shares. Some of these may be quite successful with quite small shares because they're intended to appeal to very narrow audiences. Is that right?
Yes. Doc Cat would be.
They never expect
a good example,
to have a lot of registrants. They look like they're unimportant, but in fact, they do very well in the quote market that they're attempting to serve. So it's going to be a little trickier when we look at the numbers about shares, interpreting what a very small share means. Some might be about to exit because they can't make any money, and others might say we did just what we expected to do.
So why don't I suggest as a way forward, we take these two subtopics, move them up to the market definition for the moment, and then there's a separate question that Stan just posed, which is how do we evaluate the success of TLDs that are targeted at small markets? Does that make sense?
Small
segments, yeah.
Awesome. This is Jonathan.
Right. Maybe we could put that in market too.
The other thing is not to forget about choice in this discussion of competition. In other words, part of what David may have been trying to get to is this notion of consumer choice and the communities created a different environment, potentially created a different kind of choice for end users and registrants, and is it too difficult to compete with .club, which is open and owned by that's actually a single register. It's not a donuts one. That's somebody else. But the, versus a community TLD. So there might be a choice question that I haven't formulated in my head yet, but that's about the end users and the ability to congregate around a community rather than a brand, for example.
So that might be something like are these different types of players equally effective or equally capable of providing consumer choice?
Yeah, something like that. Does the market lend itself to fair competition between, community versus open versus brand TLDs? I mean, I guess I don't know the.
But now you're back to phrasing it as a competition question again.
Right. No, that's right.
I think, David, again, I think it...
I don't have it completely. I was trying to...
Yeah, no, it is. It's the choice aspect. If you're going and you're choosing your TLD to go to when they're both in the route, which might tie into your singular plural where you've got a .pet and a .pets or a .sport and a .sports, if one of them's a community and one of them's a brand and the brand is saying it's... You've got all those aspects which come into play, and if you're a community trying to hold your own in a marketplace, you're not going to be able to hold your own against a large brand or a large portfolio player who's got it or whatever. So
is it maybe that do different types of TLDs provide, and let there be light, do different types of TLDs increase the range of consumer choice? Is that the question we're trying to ask?
Have community TLDs been able to provide an effective choice?
Alternative to standard.
Alternative is the word I'm looking for.
So maybe have community and brand. Do we care about geos? Have different types of TLDs provided effective alternatives to standard TLDs, and then we can look at each of community, brand, geo. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. These are really linked, right? In the right, right.
Kylie has his hand raised.
All right, Kylie, go ahead. Everyone, be quiet so we can hear Kylie.
Hi. Yes. Yeah. Well, as a matter of fact, I believe that we need answers to those fundamental questions. That is the question I asked, for example, what is the goal for competition? How would consumer choice benefit the consumers, et cetera? I understand that we're already mandated to with these assumptions. However, we do need the answers to these fundamentals. Otherwise, it will be hard to proceed. So what I would like to know, what are the answers to these questions before I can proceed? Otherwise, if I don't know whether the competition is good for consumers or it's not even feasible, then there's no way to proceed. But I do not see the answers so far.
All right, thanks. Thanks, Kylie. For those didn't hear, I think Kylie was mostly rephrasing the question that he had stated earlier, which is we need to understand the purpose and the benefits of competition before we get to these other before we get to the other questions, because it's fundamental to the discussion. So we did discuss this briefly before Kylie and concluded that we were going to take it as a given that competition was good, but not necessarily that this particular instance of competition was worth any potential costs, that there wasn't a net benefit necessarily. Kylie, can I suggest, just for the purpose of today's discussion, since we made that decision earlier, I'll talk to you offline and we'll see if there's a way to weave this back in and make sure your concerns are being addressed. And in the meantime, we'll move through the others and hopefully assume for the moment that we're just going to assess whether or not there is competition as opposed to whether or not competition is inherently good. We will take a look at whether the benefits of this instance of competition is worth the costs or not. Does that work for you, Kylie?
Yes. However, there, for example, in the telecom industry, for fixed landline, competition is no good. For wireless, cellular competition is good. So this is not uncommon. It may not be uncommon in our industry as well. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Kylie. Yeah, Kylie drew the analogy to fixed landlines versus mobile competition, where you see different characteristics or ways that regulators have approached those markets, I guess. We'll like I said, I'll follow up offline with Kylie, and we'll make sure that his concerns get addressed here. Let's move down through our topics, though. Actually, I'm going to take a really quick pause. Just looking at, so we have half an hour left. I think there's zero chance we're going to get to the second topic on our agenda, which is what the data that we needed. So I'm going to propose that we get through this and figure out what our high-level questions is. And then on our next call, which we will try to talk through in the agenda, we focus exclusively on identifying data that we need in order to answer these questions. And we can all take as homework in the meantime to come prepared for that conversation with what we think we need. Does that work for everyone?
Jordan, a question.
Yeah.
So I have these two previous iterations. Should I get rid of these that I've highlighted here?
Yeah, I think those are encapsulated. I think we ended up on that third version.
Okay. That's what I thought. I just want to be sure.
And then we do want sub-bullets under the third version for each of community, brand, and geo.
Thank you,
Does that look right?
All right, let's scroll down to the next bullet. How has the introduction of the new TLDs affected competition between registrars? That's a new question for us. And that's my question. I'm going to say that's well formed already. Does that sound like a question we want to try to answer, and do we want to change it at all? Lotto nodded. Right. All right. So Jonathan's suggesting that is a good high-level question. So let's move that up, as is. To what extent have new gTLDs displaced legacy gTLDs and ccTLDs, and is that good for competition price? This, I think, is another market definition question. Is that true? So we don't currently have CCs up in our market definition. So why don't we put them up there and use that as the exercise for this? Yeah. Well, for some definition of the market, that competition. I'm learning from Stan.
It's Jonathan. I guess that to parse that a little bit, that question may be also asking whether or not there's competition between the new gTLDs and legacy TLDs or competition within gTLDs, right? In other words, if the goal is just promote competition, it could be we've created this competitive new gTLD market, but they may not have at least had an immediate impact on legacy TLDs. And that's sort of buried in this question.
Sure. So,
in addition to a market definition.
Well, I guess I do think that if we include legacy TLDs in the market as well, then we would have seems like you would have to consider the effect on legacy TLDs in that
segment. Yeah.
Go ahead, Megan.
Excuse me. So far as I recall, when the whole new gTLD round was introduced, it was based on an assessment that more competition in the field was necessary, that the legacy TLDs were too limited, and that the two previous rounds were also very limited. So we have that basic premise that introducing new gTLDs would, by definition, expand market use, the market, and competition. So I think we have to take that into consideration. That was one of the premises of the...
So what I will take away from Jonathan's intervention is we also need to make sure legacy TLDs are included in the market evaluation.
One of them, yeah.
As we consider potential markets, legacy TLDs needs to be considered as well. So, Aliza, just make sure up in the market definition section we have ccTLDs and legacy TLDs flagged.
So I have this sub-bullet here. Does that capture what you're talking about?
Sure. We can just move it up there and refine it over time. That's fine. How to segment the market, that is, I think, I guess that's a further refinement potentially. Do we know who posed this question?
I did.
Go. Sure.
It's actually just another way of saying what Stan has suggested, which is that we're going to come up with a number of theories for markets. And so an example, the analysis report where they came up with a market for commerce, for example, that's a potential market segment that we might look at to see that there was, in fact, increased competition in that segment.
So is that already covered by the existing?
I think it might be. So that's what the point. So
right.
I think it's sort of.
Right. Okay. So we will consider this already covered. Cost and cost structure. So this is, to what extent do ICANNs? Is this intended to be limited? I think this is Carlton's question. I wonder if it's intended to be limited to ICANN cost and cost structure, or includes like registry services and so on. Go ahead, Stan, and then Megan.
My interpretation is that this was originally about whether or not were the costs of operating a registry primarily fixed cost or variable cost. That makes a difference. If they're primarily fixed costs, then you have to have some minimum number of registrants in order to cover your costs, and so that's an important factor. So understanding the cost structure of operating a registry is important. Now, I got up in the middle of the night last night and said, well, that's an incomplete answer. And it's an incomplete answer because some people operate more than one registry. So it turns out that you might be able to operate a small, rather apparently unsuccessful registry if it's part of some bigger enterprise. And in fact, when the analysis group does this, they do market shares for registry operators, some of which operate multiple registries. Even that analysis is incomplete, as I termed today, because I learned this because there are people called registry service providers. So you can be a registry without actually doing anything. You could subcontract this to somebody who has economies of scale. So we want to understand how this operates. I was thinking that a lot of people would drop out of the market, these small guys. Much more plausible, they'll merge. And so one might expect over time consolidation if there are registries that are essentially too small to operate on their own. That's all.
Okay, so Megan, did you have something else to add?
No, I was
okay.
Colleague.
Oh, okay, colleague, go ahead.
Well, he's dropped off the phone, and
oh.
Now he's trying the computer mic, but it doesn't seem to be working.
Okay. All right, I'm going to suggest a path forward while we see if Kylie can get voice working or maybe type something. So it seems like what we're interested here is, are the new GTLD businesses viable over the long term? And a sub-bullet of that would be to examine the cost structures involved with operating them. Is that, do we care about the cost structure of the cost structure sake, or do we care about it as a means to some broader question? Megan and
yeah, this is Megan. Well, my question, sorry to do this, but my question is, do we really care if it's viable over the long run? I mean, if competition hasn't changed or nothing's happened, then whether they disappear or not is almost irrelevant. If it has increased competition, then we have an argument to say, yes, this is something that was good and useful and should continue. I mean, aside all the arguments about how much money I can get from it, et cetera, those we won't go into.
Okay, what we'll do here. I think we'll be interested in the cost structure of the new GTLDs if we also had the cost structure of the legacy so that we could do a comparison purpose. We'd know then that they're going to be viable if the comparison is favorable.
And if it turned out that minimum viable scale is really, really big, you got to be as big as .com to compete, that creates one answer. On the other hand, it might turn out that competition is quite viable at sizes substantially smaller than .com, which would make the market very competitive. So in a sense, we're asking the question, what is the minimum viable scale and how many of the new entrants have achieved that, taking into account the fact that you could combine two GTLDs under the same owner or use the services of a RSP.
Right. Okay, so I like Stan's formulation. Is everyone okay with the question, what is the minimum viable scale for a TLD registry? And then we can ask the cost structure is going to get incorporated there. And Kylie has just said, let me just read Kylie's intervention, and then if the fixed cost is big for providing service and the variable cost is small, just like the fixed line network, this industry is a natural monopoly, and introducing competition is no good, or is unlikely to succeed. So one thing we want to include in the minimum viable scale is fixed versus variable costs as part of the analysis. Yeah. And how the magnitude of both of them as well. They could be that they're all fixed, but they're really small, in which case you still wouldn't need very much scale.
Can I just ask excuse me a second. I just want to ask a clarifying question for this last one that we have. We have, what is the minimum viable scale for a TLD registry? That presumes minimum viable scale to stay in the market, continue, et cetera. Not just, that's how you're interpreting it. Yeah, good. That was just what I wanted to clarify. Okay, in that case, fine.
Great. David?
David, and I think that will depend on who is running it as well, won't it? So as long as we're covering that. Because a minimal viable for a single TLD is not going to be the same as a minimal viable for a portfolio of TLD.
Yeah.
So there's that.
All right. We will get into that. And Margie?
I just have a question about this question, because Your assumption and your question is that everyone that's in it is doing it for money, and they may be in it for it might be a nonprofit, and there might be philanthropical reasons why they're in there. So I just want you to realize that that's what your assumption is in that question.
Right, so we could create a sub bullet here, which is, are there registry operators willing to operate TLD regardless of its profitability? Well, they might not. Well, so for example, a brand TLD might not cover its costs, right? It's purely an exercise in it serves I actually think in many cases, and I'll say Google included, the point of the TLDs is not to make money off of selling SLDs. That might be a nice side benefit, but there's more strategic objectives for the entity involved in operating the TLD, and that's definitely true for a lot of brand applicants, I would assume. And it may be true for less crass commercial reasons for some entities as well, like dot cancer research.
A project for people much more knowledgeable than I, which is there are 900 of these guys. It'd be nice to be able to characterize them by these. How many are nonprofits? How many are owned by the same operator? How many use back office services from somebody else? Otherwise, you just look at them. For me, it's
probably in the master document, right?
Yeah.
That's exactly what we have in this master document we're working on. It has how many are, who are they owned by, so you can click on registered operator donuts and see how many are donuts, how many have the same registry service provider. You can kind of slice and dice it in those categories.
Perfect.
So, and you guys, are you sharing what the headings of the master document look like to make sure that all of Stan's questions will be addressable?
We're working on, there's a piece of it that gets complicated that has to do with where they are geographically, and that has to do with the countries where they are, and we're trying to figure out how best to represent that. To make it clear.
All right. So next one, I'm going to move on because of time. The data on retail prices, I think that's just up, those moves up to the price competition heading. Market forces cannot be the only... Oh! Yeah, I know. So I think we got to yesterday, this was a question about non-price competition. Is that what everyone else's recollection is? Stan? That particular question was retail prices. I agree that we also care about wholesale prices, so we can put that up in the top heading. And Jonathan's right, we should also include secondary market considerations in the price competition heading. And returning to the next bullet about market forces, I think we... Let's just copy and paste that up into the non price competition for now. That's my recollection. Yeah. I think so, but we'll consolidate this stuff later on. TLD versus CCTLD price. Let's move that up to price competition. Universal acceptance. So this is an issue of whether they work. So it's both a competition and a consumer choice question, I think.
Is a new TLD a valid choice for a registrant if there's not universal acceptance of it?
So that sounds like a good way to phrase the question. Does that work for everyone? You get that, Alika?
You can put in BetsyArt.gallery as an example. That's my wife's website.
All right.
I get to hear about it all the time. Yeah, I get to hear about it all the time, about how I'm signing up for a bank account and they won't take .gallery.
All right. Impact of competition of new gTLDs in areas where the uptake of ccTLDs is low. I think that goes into the market definition. Who is responsible to promote gTLDs?
So it could be. Were they sufficiently? Is the program sufficiently? Community sufficiently aware to allow for competition or
right.
Something like that? Is there sufficient awareness?
Megan is making faces. Skeptical faces.
Maybe I misunderstand this one, but, I mean, theoretically, and Stan will correct me, of course, if I'm wrong, but theoretically, if the system is adequate and it promotes competition, you don't have to go out and promote it very much anyway, because by definition,
one of the reasons might have been that there wasn't enough promotion. So just turn that on its head. I think you're absolutely right. You don't need additional promotion if you don't need promotion. But if there's not competition and there isn't sufficient awareness through normal market forces, you might end up recommending more promotion.
As of,
maybe not, right? But, I mean, our first thing that we're doing is just findings, right, which is is there enough awareness of this to promote competition? And that'll be a sub-question. But the first question is there sufficient awareness to generate competition?
Right, and it is entirely possible to say no, and that doesn't necessarily mean it's ICANN's job to do it.
Right.
It could just be this is a reason why these things aren't competing effectively, that they don't have big enough marketing budgets or something.
It could
like
be
that
not enough time as fast is one of the reasons.
Or,
why
that could be another reason. Yeah,
right.
But it could be we say, you know, the hypothetical future thing is like you can't apply for a TLD unless you have a $10 million marketing budget or something like that, so people will actually know about it. I don't think we would recommend that, but that could be.
And we become a regulator. Yeah.
But that might be, or you might say, as ICANN considers financial models, marketing budgets an important consideration to understand eventual adoption of the TLD or something like that. So, ICANN does do a financial analysis to determine whether the business model is viable as part of the application process, or they did in the last round.
This all may already be captured, but you might be interested in the strategies pursued by GTLD. I learned by rereading this report that .xyz, which is the biggest, by far the biggest of the new domains, doesn't charge anything. Well, I understand. But that's consistent with a strategy that says charge low prices at the beginning, build your network up, become an attractive place for people to want to register in the future, and raise your prices. It's a very standard kind of market penetration strategy. And I think it's captured in here, but competition is a little bit more complicated because there are strategic things that firms might do, and maybe that's what .xyz is doing.
Right. So I'm going to go back to Jonathan's formulation of this previously, which is, as opposed to, is the community sufficiently aware? Are we just asking our consumers sufficiently aware? Right. That's what I was saying. Yeah. To allow. To have for these, well, this is good. We'll work on language later on. And then, Stan, you think what you were just saying is already covered in our existing language?
Just be cognizant of the fact that we think about competition.
Right.
It's more than just what products you're offering at what prices. You may have a strategy, which is low current prices to charge higher future prices.
Right, so we'll have to consider various business models.
Think about business models. You mentioned business models.
All right, great. Are domains being allocated more efficiently to registrants who will use them well? Oh, go ahead,
Alana. Sorry. What do you hear? Maybe just to go back to the previous question, whether consumers are sufficiently aware. Why do we restrict access to consumers? Why not even registrars? Registrars are already included in the definition.
Registrars are not included in our definition of consumers, other than when they're acting as registrars.
Some may not have good knowledge about the new GTLDs, strange enough, depending on how you define the market.
So we could add a sub-bullet. There's definitely some registrars who don't carry all of the TLDs, whether that's because of lack of awareness or not, I think is something we don't know the answer to.
Yeah.
we'll add registrars. You want to add a sub-bullet there, Lisa? Are registrars aware, just to make sure we remember what we mean? Are domain names being allocated more efficiently to registrants who will use them well? This is my question. I'm not sure if we have any way to try to answer this question, so it may be that we don't care. Go ahead, Stan.
Back to something. The question of who the consumer is a little confusing. Here's how what the analysis group says. The final stage of refinement is then undertaken by the customer. After obtaining a registration of a domain name by a registrar, the consumer can choose to create blah, blah, blah. They're treating the registrant as a consumer.
Right, so we, in our definition, the, So both the registrar is a consumer in our definition, and so is an internet. The registrant is, and so is an internet user. I think we're going to attempt to also use the specific terms registrant and internet user, where we specifically mean one category of them in order to make it clear what we're talking about. So in that, we would have said registrant instead of consumer. All right. Do we want to try to answer this question of allocation to registrants?
And it's your question?
It is my question.
Can you clarify it?
So yeah, if you go scroll around in .com, or if anyone that's tried to get a .com has often found that the domain name is registered to someone not doing anything particularly with it, and not using it well. Well, I guess Waldo has this experience, and so do you. The question is, part of that is the price cap on .com, because there's an arbitrage opportunity, right? If someone can buy a domain for $10, then it might be worth $10,000. So you would, as a speculator, you might want to get a lot of those. I guess my question would be, have the new TLDs have different or more effective pricing or allocations? You know, you could imagine pricing strategies are quite common now with premium names. They'll say, well, I'm not going to sell the name until someone's willing to pay more money. It might be they would only charge $5,000, but it decreases the arbitrage opportunity, and that makes it more likely someone who actually used the name will get it. And similarly, they might just, you know, you could imagine, I don't think anyone's doing this, at the extreme end, a registry could have an RFP process, right? They could say, oh, I'm only going to give you your name if you tell me what you're going to do with it and you're going to do something awesome. And so the question here is just like, there's valuable namespace, essentially. Is it being better utilized post-program than pre-program? I think it's an interesting question. I'm not sure how we would go about answering it. All right. Jonathan says it's a great question. Do other people want to keep this in the...
The way it's framed is quite okay.
Dan.
We can put it in sub-bullets connected with the choice.
So, yeah, I think we can group this under choice, but for the moment, let's just leave it as a standalone question for time, and I'll do some editing afterwards. We'll figure out how to consolidate to roll some of this stuff up.
More of an overall good, which is this is the system more inclined to lead to, well, as part of the problem, but, I mean, is it more inclined to lead to what we would call typical or helpful usage of the TLD or something like that?
Yeah. All right. Do Internet users expect different TLDs to have different types of registrants? I think that's a separate question that we haven't asked yet. This is a consumer choice question for Internet users, not for registrants, I think. I mean, it could also be for registrants, but I guess the question is, if you look at it, if you see .scientist, and you expect that a real scientist is on the other end, that gives you an option that versus going to .engineering or .dumb, where you're not going to get a scientist. So that's why I would think of it as a choice question. But in any case, I think it's an important question to answer about consumer expectations. I don't know if this belongs here in the safeguards discussion, though. Jonathan?
Excuse me, that question is actually in the Nielsen report.
So what I'm going to suggest is that we keep this question here and we coordinate with the trust group. We shouldn't try to answer this question twice. But we should make sure
at least get the same answer.
Well, I don't know what you think overall, Chair, but I would prefer that we try to coordinate on key topics and make sure one group or the other is owning them. But I don't know if you have thoughts on that.
I guess I don't feel strongly, and we don't want to expend a lot of time in coordination that might take more time than coming up with two answers, because we'll end up coordinating anyway. But we can try to do that. But it may come down to phrasing, too, because I feel like that the part of this is about, may speak back to our market definition in a way that does this explosion of new TLDs create a new form of value in the DNS through a type of segmentation or something like that? In other words, is it, and I this is ill-formed at this point, but the idea being if I disincented the use of a search engine or something by saying now come to info.doctor might be the place that I, you know, if I created competition in that sense by improving consumer welfare in the DNS generally by creating market segments or something. I don't know. I'm not fully formed, but.
It's a label and, sorry, David, it's a label and it's an expectation. So it's definitely consumer choice. So you go to it because you're expecting to find something there. And in the same way, you see that now with the disputes on the UDRP. Before you'd say a .com, you ignore the .com. Whereas now if you've got a .bike and you see a bike manufacturer in there, you now look at the .bike. So you're looking at it as a label, which a consumer must be looking at a label when they register in the first place. So I think that...
Right. If I look at, this is Jonathan again, I'm sorry, if I look at competition against, using against legacies, right, that com is generic, right, just means company. And so if I created a form of competition by creating a narrowing of that search field so that I'm looking for a bicycle or something like that, or we may find it in the commerce area, right, that shop or something like that, again, that I'm drawn to a subset by a TLD, and so if I create a competition in that way, is why I see it as a potentially a
right. So can I suggest maybe we move this question up to the benefits versus cost of choice above, where we say do these more segmented namespaces and potentially more regulated namespaces provide a benefit to consumers, better navigation experience or something like that for internet users.
And I agree on the regulated thing, and we may not be able to answer this question either. You and I talked about it a little bit, Jordan, is that will there be a natural proclivity for people to self-select into these categories even absent regulation? Will be more likely to find photographers in .photography or whatever, and even though it's not regulated and nobody's actually appraising, will something natural happen that, of course, has improved consumer welfare?
Yeah.
David here. I was going to say, and that ties in perfectly with the competition because you're looking at something where it's a label, so .photography. So you're thinking you're going to have people interested in photography. You may have some sort of selection of people, but then it's a competition point as well because at the end of the day, the registry operator wants to sell domain names and doesn't really care who registers in them, whether it's anything to do with photography or to do with film. So I think you've got aspects there which.
But a registry might make this, Jonathan, and may make a decision to advertise.
A mean chair and
Cut
off this conversation.
Just throw it in as a question.
Yeah.
And you don't
so that's right. So let's move this. I don't want to move it as phrase, but up in the competition versus choice, let's say is segmentation and regulation, is further segmentation and regulation of the namespace valuable to consumers navigating to internet sites and to promote competition? And we'll have to come back and revisit this. We're in bad shape for time, so I've clearly failed in my chair duties. So I think what I'm going to propose is we're going to have to do two things. We're going to have to take the remainder of these. I will I'll work offline, and if anyone wants to work with me to work these back up into key questions and send that around to the group. And then I want to spend a couple minutes before we totally run out of time to just talk about work cadence and milestones and deliverables and so on. Actually, really what I want to do is get us to the next meeting at least. So what do folks think about meeting cadence for this subgroup, recognizing that it's in addition to the existing meetings that we already have as the CCTRT as a whole? Do we want to? I would suggest maybe another biweekly, which means we're really meeting every week, or at least on that much time commitment. We could do it opposite in the same, you know, we could do it opposite the other ones, or we could do it the same week or whatever. But I think that's roughly the right cadence. But Megan is making a face again, so why don't you take the mic?
Sorry, I shouldn't make so many faces. It's Megan for the record. You can't see my face, luckily. No, I'm just wondering, instead of having another meeting, can we not do a lot of this, as you call it, offline? You're going to do some work now. You're going to exchange it. We're going to be meeting in Marrakesh in 2 weeks anyway. Can we not squeeze in a time during the Marrakesh meetings that we can have another meeting?
Well, we're going to have 2 days of meetings in Marrakesh.
Exactly. But can we not squeeze in the subgroup re-meeting during that period?
That seems fine as a next. Yes. Correct. That will help us in 2 weeks. It will not help us forever over the... But I am fine to kick the can down the road to Marrakesh, just given where we are in terms of time. It's just 2 weeks, that's correct. So, therefore, though we need homework, we're going to work offline. We're all going to be good, diligent workers. And so, let's identify the homework that we need to do between now and when we meet in Marrakesh. So, one thing is I need to go take a pass through this document, identify the key questions that we're going to try to answer, consolidate stuff, clean up language, move these last few things up. I will circulate that to all of you when you all, before we get to Marrakesh, I think, we all have to have agreed upon those things. And actually, I'm going to set a deadline to try to make that happen by, when are we all going to start traveling to Marrakesh? Let's say by the first. That's a good time. So by the first, we're going to have to all agree on this document that these are the questions that we're trying to answer as part of this subgroup. And therefore, everyone's going to come prepared in Marrakesh with their answers to what information do we need in order to try to answer these questions. And we'll spend most of our time in Marrakesh focused on figuring out what the information that we need is. And that will then lend itself to figuring out the rest of our work plan. And Jonathan has something to say.
Yeah, I just want to get to the implications of that. Does that mean they will have familiarized themselves with the resources that have already been identified in terms of metrics and things so that they come prepared to understand what supplementary information? Is that what you mean?
No. I do think separately, Jonathan, we may want to identify the metric ninjas between now and Marrakesh and make them someone from this team should be a metric ninja. And so when someone says, I need to know X, then the metric ninja can say, aha, we already have that in this data set. And so I think it is fine for members of the subteam as a whole to ask, sort of to say, this is the type of information I need. And then between staff and our metric ninjas, we'll identify whether we have that information or not already. Okay, does that make sense? All right. And we're basically kicking the can down the road on everything else. I may try to work with Jonathan and with staff to figure out if there's some other milestones that we want to try to identify going into Marrakesh in terms of our work plan. We won't discuss those today. So I will wrap things up unless anyone disagrees with the homework, wants to add more homework, or thinks there's something else we need to talk about before we get to the joint session again.
So, Jordan, I'll send this document around to the sub-team.
Why don't send it to me first.
Okay.
We'll continue to work it a little bit, and then we'll send it around to the sub-team.
Got it.
And if anyone else wants to be involved in that little exercise, just let me know.
And this is Jonathan. I guess I'll, speaking as chair now that we're all sort of reconvened before we take our break, I think what seems to be percolating up is that a large portion of our time in Marrakesh should be spent in the subteams. Given the high priority of identifying supplemental work, and that's kind of one of the number one things, that a large portion of our time will be spent that way.
That's what your next session is about.
All right, so I'm going to call this meeting of subteam competition and choice to a close, and we'll see. You'll all have homework, which we'll remind you of, and the teacher will be very grumpy if you don't do it. More importantly, though, I think we can't hold up the data gathering exercise much further than Marrakesh. So if you're not prepared, you're probably not going to get the data that you want. And we will we'll reconvene in Marrakesh, and we'll circulate the list of key questions. Everyone will agree on the list of key questions by March 1st, and silence is compliance as of March 1st. All right. The end.
And that's a break. We'll reconvene at 4.
we're ready to start.
So, of course, we lost David at the end of the break period. It's just a perennial problem that you said there's a 15-minute break. Everyone waits till minute 14 and then leaves the room.
So is this like the official brand?
Oh, yes. So that for those who don't know, I signed one of the emails with a picture of Fearless Leader, who is the villain from the Rocky and Bullwinkle show that used to be on television a long time ago. And in the United States, that's right. My guess is that it was actually very widespread, being a cartoon. I bet it was in a lot of markets. So it's meant to be a little bit ironic. What am I looking at on the screen?
I can clutch time in here. I just sent out a few minutes ago a revised version of the conflict of interest policy that we spoke about yesterday. And Erica Randall has returned to talk you through the changes that were made. So if you don't mind, we can hand it over to her.
That'd be great.
Aliza, if you scroll to section, I think it's 2.2. As Aliza mentioned, she sent out the revised version of the conflicts of interest policy, taking into account some of the feedback that we received yesterday. And so essentially what we've done is we added a paragraph D to section 2.2. And so the paragraph is intended to acknowledge the fact that many people who are on the review team have direct experience in the new GTLD program, and essentially that's, you know, part of the reason why you're on the review team. And so that the presumption is that everyone on the review team would participate in all the discussions and the voting, and that it's really a rare circumstance under which someone would have to abstain from voting because the review team has, you know, gone through the process and sort of determined that on this particular matter or in this particular circumstance that there is an actual conflict. So it just kind of gives more language and clarity around that so that when you if the situation does arise, that language and that presumption is recognized by the policy. So I think that will help to address some of the questions that came up yesterday. So if there are any other questions, though, or comments? Yeah, it's paragraph D. And also the new language sort of notes that having an abstention is intended to be in extraordinary cases. So, again, the presumption is that everyone participates, everyone votes. So hopefully that addresses some of the concerns you had yesterday.
Thanks, Erica. Were there any other concerns that were raised this year besides this one, or is this the primary one that you out of the paragraph four?
Yeah, this is the primary one that I think that when we discussed yesterday, we said we would take those comments back and then kind of revise it based on that discussion.
So, it's Megan Richards for the record. Just to clarify, so now the conflict of interest arises only in the case where the covered person has direct experience in the new GTLD program. It has nothing to do with any of the other legacy or any other issue. Isn't that correct? That's how I read this new version. So then the definition of conflict and the potential conflict is limited to just the new GTLD program. Is that correct?
No, the definition of conflict has still remained the same. I think this new paragraph is intended to acknowledge the fact that there are many people on this review team, if not everyone, I'm not sure the entire makeup, but that have direct experience, like either served as applicants or advised applicants in the new GTLD program, and sort of that knowledge is kind of what helps them to participate on the review team and add value to it. So it's kind of acknowledgement of the fact that this is kind of a special type of review team and that the issues that you may be discussing weigh directly on, like, the program in which you were involved, but it's kind of needed in this particular case. So it's meant to – so that the policy kind of recognizes that, that when you're evaluating potential conflicts of interest, you kind of have that in mind, and that doesn't necessarily mean that an actual conflict exists. And the key thing, again, is, you know, just about disclosing it so that people know kind of what your position is or the clients that you've advised, you know, to the extent that you can disclose that and those kinds of things. And then if there needs to be, like, the formal decision made by the non-conflicted members of the review team that these factors are taken into account when that decision is being made.
Sorry, and you may have mentioned this already. Did the definition of family get revised? Sorry, Jordan Buchanan.
No, that definition remained the same.
All right, I read a dictionary definition yesterday that says ancestors means progenitors beyond your grandparents. So by that definition, parents and grandparents wouldn't be included in that definition, which I assume is not your intent, but I think it demonstrates that the word is problematic, yeah.
Or irrelevant, because there wasn't an ICANN, there wasn't at the...
But I do assume that ICANN intends that my parents are included in my family.
We do intend that. I mean, if we can... but again, I think we can... I'm happy to go back and, like, change the definition of that, if that would make it more clear. But I think the idea is that...
It works. I mean, it's not a clear definition.
Okay, great.
I mean, I'm sympathetic. I know that especially when you've used things before, there's a resistance to changing them, but that word is extraordinarily problematic. If even the dictionary defines it as something that you clearly do not intend, that to me is a signal that it's ambiguous, and you don't want it to be ambiguous. We don't want it to be ambiguous either.
Sure. Okay, that's fine.
David, for the record, like Jordan, I looked up the definition yesterday. And I think it's capturing things that you don't want it to capture, because on the Merriam-Webster, for instance, the full definition of an ancestor, one from whom a person is descended and who is usually more remote in the line of descent than a grandparent. So you're right up on grandparents there, which is kind of a little bit too far.
Right. So in any case, this is Jordan. I think it would be helpful to just say specifically, you know, if you mean parents, say parents. If you also mean grandparents, say grandparents. Presumably you don't care about great-grandparents or great-great-great-grandchildren. So, but in any case, I think just explicitly listing what you mean would be helpful.
Okay, we'll take that back.
My great-grandfather used to bounce me on his knee and say, without competition, there is no justice. Influence everything that I've done since then. It's just stuck with me.
So,
I hereby disclose that.
So Erica will send a new version to me, and I'll circulate that to the team.
Anything else? Enjoy the rest of your talk.
Anything else, you jerks? We don't sign the conflict of interest policy, but it is, in fact, referenced in the statement of interest that we do need to re-sign. Recertify, because it's a new document and refers to a new document. That's right. So it's like signing it, I guess.
May I? Can I jump in for a moment?
You can, yeah. If you want to lead this conversation, then.
Well, not necessarily lead it. Just your next 48 minutes that are remaining, we're supposed to be devoted to a wrap up and planning for the Marrakesh session. Just one thing we didn't get to was talking about liaisons to other streams work. I don't know if you want to talk about that now, or if that's something best left to the sub teams. But just wanted to flag that for your attention.
Thanks, and thanks for writing up this list. These are the things I was going to bring up. The other issue is identifying the metrics ninjas is another bullet that goes on this list as well. And to Jordan's comment about, it might have originated with Megan, which is give us a break, we're meeting again in 2 weeks. The people for whom that is not true is this Nielsen analysis group, because we're trying to really get information to them really in the next week, by the first. So whoever signed up for that little sub-team to work on new questions for Nielsen, et cetera, in parallel with the work that he's doing. So that starts right away and should probably have a call soon. And that's another good reason that the subteams don't have to have calls before Americas, because that one does need to.
And sorry, quickly, Nielsen said that they would send us by tomorrow a revised version of the questionnaire, so I'll have that to you by tomorrow.
Just a quick question, Jonathan. It came up in our subgroup. Is there going to be this is Lorene speaking. Thank you, Megan.
Chairman Lorene.
Is there an expectation that our subgroups are going to have time within the scheduled time in Marrakesh to meet? Yes.
So, yeah, you might not have been back there. I think a very substantial amount of time in Marrakesh will be devoted, and we'll circulate that. I'll work with Aliza to come up with a proposal for what that might look like. But a very substantial, again, I think with the principal reason being dealing with the notion of supplemental research that that might want to be launched in parallel. The other issue is these interim recommendations, too, that the extent to which we're recommending some other process to be launched, a PDP process or whatever it might be, sooner rather than later is the deadline for those as well. So both teams will want to sort of prioritize the need for outside research and interim recommendations that we talked about. But that's not within a week or anything. Okay, so did identify who was on that group, right? The Nielsen? I guess once we have that, we should schedule a call within a couple of days after the receipt of this updated version so we know what we're working from with that group, and set a deadline of getting some suggestions back to them, very shortly after, I think by the 1st. Because they want to field this within the first week of March if they can.
When are they planning to field the registrant study?
I believe it's May or June.
And this is Lorene again. Could we get an email subgroup a list for the competition subgroup and the consumer trust subgroup, just so it's for ease of circulation?
Yes, we can.
We can create two email lists. Any others? Do you want a Nielsen one as well, or have that be on the main list?
I think that'll actually just be private list, private distribution initially, because it's going to be so short-lived. I guess the question that I'd like to raise again to that point is that Lorene and I spoke at dinner last night and came up with a little bit of a kludge that she could use to make use of both things like Google Docs and a tool like Slack. So before we disband entirely, are there others that besides me that feel strongly that we ought to come up with something an alternative to email as a way to manage our discussion threads? So Carlos feels strongly about it. So are there others as well? Because if so, then do we want to talk about alternatives? Do people like Slack as a possible alternative? Because I think we've maybe come up with a solution for Lorene that she could not be left out of that decision, which was really the issue before, because they have a clean room there for when they want to go, look for malware and things like that, right? So I just want to open that up briefly for conversation, whether you think that's worth it. Carlos obviously did. I do think so, but I want to make sure that the group feels strongly generally.
Yep. I'm happy to try anything like that. I've never used Slack, though.
Right. And just for those that aren't aware, tools like Slack and others like it are about just maintaining threaded conversations that are more granular. So, for example, we could set up threads that are related to each of these high-level questions in the review, and it would maintain a threaded conversation about underserved communities, right, was one of the ones that we had, et cetera, and as opposed to finding where those things were based on how people titled emails and things. It'd be like sections where that conversation took place. And presumably for our transparency requirements, we could do a dump periodically of the Slack and post it on the wiki or something. To make sure that those conversations weren't necessarily confidential. It's just another way to structure the conversation.
Does it also include, this is Lorene, does it also include the group work on documents, or is it something else?
It's basically something else. There can be documents that are posted in Slack, like resources. But we already have the wiki that's really our central resource, so we probably wouldn't want to replicate that functionality. The wiki is sort of the source of reference documents and things. But the notion of document collaboration, which is where I put a document up on a server and allow multiple people to place comments and change edits to it, is a separate functionality that we would use, for which we would use Google Docs or Office 365. But you would still have the same issue with your people, but you could still solve it the same way. But the two different solutions to two different problems. One's conversation management, the other is document management. Other questions about that? Strong feelings one way or the other? Objections to it? No. It's free. I don't know. I can look into that. If it costs, it's not a substantial cost. And I think it's one that we can probably burden our budget with if we need to. I don't know, staff, if you've had experience with it and your teams have tried it and you were secretly seething about it as we're talking about it or anything like that. So please feel speak up and inform us if you have strong feelings as well.
I think our team kind of tried it, but we didn't really give it enough of a try. I think there are other teams within ICANN that are using it. It's gotten mixed reviews, but we're happy to try it if that's what works for everyone. Yeah, it's the same tool, Slack. Uh-huh.
Email notification option. That's right. There is some email integration. In other words, you can create email addresses out of these threads so that if you wanted to, you could email to a thread and not have to go into Slack in order to post a comment to the thread. Now, one of the limitations, for example, is if an entire thread has happened, you can't go midway back up and hit, like you can in Facebook, you can reply to one of the comments in the middle of a thread, and you can't do that as easily, right? So that's part of the value of having these kind of granular distinctions. Is that it's a continuous conversation. You're always appending to the end. You can't branch from the middle of a conversation. Right.
I can look into it. I'm not sure.
Enterprise is coming in 2016, it says.
Okay. But it's in the $6 to $12 a month range, so I don't think it's going to be something that it's like Dave's taxi in Marrakesh. So it's not like it's $400 or anything like that.
If you didn't hear that story at lunch, you need to hear it.
So David here for the record. So following on our Marrakesh theme, does that mean we pay $6 to be able to have the use? And then at the end of the year, if we want to have access to our emails and all our stuff, we have to pay $6,000 to get back in.
That's right. And we could try it, and if it's not working, stop using it, right? I mean, but I think that you'll find that it's an easier way to keep track of the different conversations that are going on. So I'm just speaking from PTSD surrounding the CCWG process. And all the emails that went there. And obviously we won't generate quite as many of those, but it was...
13,900.
Yeah. It was insane.
Are we going to start using it right away or after?
Since we have some specific to-dos prior to Marrakesh for a very small subset, why don't we make part of the agenda a little bit of a discussion of it and a little demo of it or something like that in Marrakesh and finalize the decision there. Okay. Thank you. And so then the other thing is the Metric Ninjas. If you're interested in being a part of Aliza's Metric Ninja team, since we're losing one of our Metric Ninjas to some vaguely worded PhD program, I just wish we could put some flesh on the bones of that concept. Then please let her know. And this is about becoming familiar with the metrics that we already have in place, where things are, and just being in a little bit better position to sort of notify a group. So there should be somebody in each sub-team that is the liaison, if you will, that's like, oh, yeah, we do have a metric that covers that thing that you're talking about, which is So if you're interested in that, then let Lisa know. So then the last part here was this notion of liaisons to these streams of related work. So Karen at one point, I think, provided this list of things that are going on in parallel, and I know this group has had a lot of questions along the way. What about this? This is going on too. How does this relate to our work? And so Karen covered that to some extent you know, what's meant to be sort of critical path to our work. But I guess the question is, if there's opportunities to cooperate, to be able to maintain awareness of what those other groups are doing, it would be great if we could identify people on this team to be kind of liaisons to those groups, whether it's just making an occasional call to that chair. I don't think it means you have to be on that working group or anything like that. It's just about keeping the lines of communication open. Oh, we're covering that too, or we just commissioned a study about that X, Y, Z, and so we're not duplicating efforts. And so I had volunteered for the GTLD Marketplace Health Index because it felt so relevant to what we were doing and very metric-based. But I'd be very interested in other things that people might be willing to be the liaison to, and maybe they're already on those work groups. So I open that up. You just have to list in front of you if people would like to self-identify.
Drew messaged me earlier that he was interested in working as a liaison for the DNS abuse review.
Oh, excellent. So he hopefully will come back with a definition of DNS abuse as a result of those activities. Trademark Clearinghouse. What do you mean by natural liaison?
Are people already on?
No, that's right. So I'm asking people, I'm opening it up for people to self-identify as being either interested or already a part of a working group or something like that. So don't be shy.
So is there anyone also participating in any of these other processes?
No, I'm happy to follow the RPM PDP working group as long as it doesn't suddenly involve me providing reports to the RPM PDP working group about all what we're doing as well, because that's where it all starts getting a little bit insane, where you're permanently reporting each week to many, many people and can't do any work.
Yeah, and that's a good question, David. I don't know what the roles and responsibilities of this liaison would be necessarily, and I think each would find it. It might just be trying to stay in touch, and we could identify some big questions. Like, for example, if we identify a research product that we're revving up to try and have happen, it might be worth sharing that with these other groups because, A, they may be interested in it, they may be interested in kicking in and doing it together. Those kinds of things could happen. I mean, this will all be going on for significant periods of time, and it doesn't necessarily need to be a formal, I'm reporting to you each week kind of thing. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's Jordan. I proposed this role, and my intention was that it was very lightweight, just as Jonathan just suggested. It's just someone is conversant enough with both sets of activities that when you notice potential overlap or benefits that one workstream could get from the other, or in some cases we may need reports out. Like it may actually be that this group wants to know where the DNS abuse review is in their process so that we understand like how we could take that into consideration in the trust and safeguards workstream or something like that. But in the general case, it's just, oh, you're about to do something that's already being done over here, or like that work would really benefit from this other thing that we're doing on the other side, as opposed to an active role.
Fabio, for the record, maybe all these lots of documents you're using are online, NIC and websites. Maybe we can circulate the links of all of them, and then we can even search the links eventually to see if we find something as an additional task or optional task.
Right. Again, the idea isn't to create a huge homework assignment reading list or something. So my feeling is that the periodic conversations with those groups, with the chairs in those groups or something like that will probably satisfy the need, except the ones that are, in fact, critical path. Like DNS abuse reviews, we're actually considering to be a feeder to our work. So that's somebody had their hand up. Carlos, go ahead.
Yes, the two PDPs are in the initiation phase. They have not started, so they are free for everybody who wants to cooperate. We need people in the GNSO for the PDPs. And I was planning to get into the subsequent rounds, one, which is the first one there. It's not exactly the same.
You owe a dollar.
What? It's called, the official name is New GTLD Subsequent Rounds. That's the official title. We have to change
$2. Stop saying it.
Here's the page.
It's like you have to say R word.
This is the project.
Your first job is liaison. We'll get them to change their name of their PDP.
I will try.
I left the word rounds out of the notes, and I'll put a dollar in.
Wadu?
I joined Carlos in that one.
That's the first one. David in the second one. Health Index is me. Trademark Clearinghouse. The trademark, excellent. DNS, Drew, DNS Abuse Review.
Sorry, who was Trademark Clearinghouse? Ah.
And Root Stability Study. Who's interested in that?
This is Jordan. I'll reluctantly take on yet more work, but yeah, I'll take that. I was planning on following it in any case.
And I'm managing that on the staff side, so I can help you with that.
Perfect. Okay, great. Thanks, guys, for standing up. This has been a great group of people that haven't had to be voluntold for things, so that's very exciting. So, Lisa, did you have more that you'd already outlined for me, or am I winging it from here?
You're winging it from here.
So, I mean, I think what would be nice is if we could get both of the chairs that we've identified. Well, and let's first congratulate them, Lorene and Jordan, sub-team chairs. And I wonder if you'd be willing to each provide a short summary of the work that you did. And I know that it was a lot of this work here, but... you know, if you want to go through some of those things quickly, I think people would be interested.
Sure. So I'll jump in with my fabulous group. This is Lorene. My caveat, since I'm all about consumer protection and disclosure, is that this is a work in progress, and I expect that it'll change, and everyone's going to take about a week to look at it, so it'll be further refined. That said, what we tried to do was come up with buckets of issues that we see invoked by the safeguards and trust subgroup. So we took the brainstorming work that had been done, and then we tried to focus on which things went together, and then drilling down a little bit about how those issues can be further elaborated on. So we came up with two headings, four headings thus far. The first would be consumer trust, and that would include consumer and end user behavior, the ability to navigate to a domain, perhaps focusing on issues where the domain doesn't resolve, and then the use of the domain. There's also an interest in developing countries and consumer trust. There's also procedural issues, ICANN's role, dispute resolution processes, sufficient data when we're looking into these issues. Another sub-issue in consumer trust is confusion, DNS abuse, and also registry privacy policies, how easy they are to locate. Then a second bigger bucket was trademark issues. And under that heading, we have the relative costs of defensive registrations, and as a subheading to that, predatory pricing for certain domains, for example, .sucks. Other issues under that are brands protection, risk of confusion for a brand, sunrise pricing, and rights protection mechanisms. As another big subheading, we have the impact of the public interest commitments and other safeguards. Subpoints under that, compliance, complaints, whether the fact of a public interest commitment or a safeguard reduces harm. And then we have our
other category, which is information we might be interested in obtaining. This is the what else do we need category. For the compliance data that ICANN already collects, we thought it would be very useful to see if there's a way to divide that into a new GTLD versus legacy GTLD comparison, since compliance is all about collecting these statistics. They showcase them on the website. It's very organized, and I'm hopeful that with all that information gathering, they have the functionality to make that comparison for us. So that's something we want to explore. We're also interested in exploring if we can go to registries and registrars and ask them for their numbers of complaints. I mean, almost all of them have a mechanism. They certainly are required to have an abuse point of contact, so they likely all have mechanisms for collecting complaints, and we're hopeful that they might be willing to share that information with us. Drew is going to be thinking about how to compare levels of abuse among the legacy and the new GTLDs, and we're also wanting to think about highly regulated sector GTLDs and the incidence of either contractually required public interest commitments or voluntary commitments that these GTLDs may have elected to institute in their procedures, and whether there's any relationship between taking on extra commitments, for example, in verification and validation, and a lower incidence of abuse within those domains. So those are kind of our preliminary musings, and we're all going to be taking a hard look at this list that we've created to see where we can flesh it out, if we're missing something, if there's other data we think we'll need, and then we'll move on from there as far as what our priorities are, timing, and that sort of stuff, since we think we really have to define this and flesh it out a little more before we move on to timetables. So if we're missing something, please let us know in terms of what you expected us to accomplish during this time period just now.
Oh, thank you, Lorraine. You've more than met expectations, and obviously this isn't your final report on this document, but just a first start on it, so we will discuss it further. I remember being in the room with you for a short period, and one of the things that was interesting that came up in the discussion with issues of DNS abuse, et cetera, was whether or not the percentage had changed. And I wonder if that's really the only question. In other words, if the percentage remains the same, but you've multiplied it by 1,500, that might still be a net negative for consumer welfare. So I guess that's just something to put in your back pocket, that just maintaining a percentage isn't necessarily the same as not creating an increase. Looking at compliance statistics and wanting to separate them, GTLDs, and so if we say that of the number of registered TLDs, 1% of them have generated complaints, and that 1% holds in the new GTLD program, I don't think that necessarily means we can imply there wasn't an increase in DNS abuse.
Right, and I mean, in some ways, you can say, well, it's increased by the amount of the increase in GTLD, so it's a net gain. Okay.
Jordan.
Thanks. So, in the competition and choice subgroup, I think we ran through roughly a similar exercise of attempting to take the ideas for investigation that we had identified yesterday on the post-it board and turning that into some broader category headings that we could focus our work. We're not quite down to four yet. We may be able to sort of further categorize these things, but we started to pose it, to frame it in a series of questions that we would like to answer. And so the key questions that we identified were first to look at isn't even a question, so we did a bad job. oh, no, sorry, it is, because we started off with this leading heading that we then abandoned in subsequent questions. But
The first two questions we asked were, has the expansion of GTLDs been effective at promoting price competition between TLD operators? And to look at that, we would also want to look at data on retail and wholesale prices at secondary markets and the TLD versus CCTLD and presumably new GTLD versus legacy GTLD prices. We also wanted to take a look at non-price competition, and a particular sub-question there would be if competition is not founded on price, what services should be identified? Yeah, I think we have not fleshed that general topic out very much. I did not. because Jamie was not involved, we explicitly decided we were not attempting to measure innovation as part of our efforts. Sorry, Jamie, I guess you chose the wrong group to agitate in. So then a related question was whether the further segmentation and regulation of the namespace was valuable to consumers in navigating the Internet. And the sub-question of that was, do Internet users expect different TLDs to have different types of registrants? We actually think that there's some potential overlap here with the Safeguards and Trust Group, so we may just want to make sure that we're coordinating and not duplicating efforts or at least staying well-informed. Then we had a long – many of our discussions revolved around defining the relevant markets for the purpose of discussing competition. So we have this general question, which is, what are reasonable definitions of relevant markets that we might use to analyze competition and stand opine that we might end up either looking at multiple definitions of markets or saying, hypothetically, if you use this as your definition, or maybe not hypothetically, if you use this as your definition of the relevant market, then this is what we think about the effects on competition in that market, as opposed to expecting to get to a definition of relevant market that we all agreed upon was correct. Within that general heading, there were a number of areas that we thought that we would need to look at. One that we've talked about is considering non-domain names and identifiers and their effects on navigation. So that would be service providers like Facebook or apps or QR codes, et cetera, as we've been talking about in the past days. We thought we would need to look at community TLDs versus standard TLDs versus brand TLDs and see if they had an effect on how we thought about the market. Similarly, single TLDs versus portfolio registries. Another question is how do we evaluate the success of a TLD that's targeted at a small consumer segment? So .cat is not a new TLD, but it's the canonical example that we often return to of people often say that's a very successful TLD, even though there's only like 50,000 registrations or something in it, but it serves the Catalonian market extremely effectively. And to what extent have GTLDs, new GTLDs replaced legacy GTLDs or CCTLDs is something that we'll need to look at. And in particular, is the impact of competition of new GTLDs in areas of uptake where CCTLDs are low. So that will all fall into the sort of market definition conversation. A separate question that we identified that we want to answer is, in addition to the effect that the new TLDs might have on a broader market of or potential market of domain identifiers, including like Facebook pages or QR codes, what are the effects of external factors to the domain name industry, like new technologies, on the introduction of new GTLDs? So is the fact that there are QR codes, does that affect the uptake of the new GTLDs and the effect of competition? And then a really important, our sort of key heading on the topic of choice is, have the benefits of the increase in choice outweighed the potential of the cost of confusion with the new TLDs? So I think that's, yes, exactly, another potential intersection. So that's a key question we'll be looking at on the choice topic. Another question is, have the new types of TLDs been able to provide effective alternatives to other TLDs? Once again, looking at community versus standard versus brand and single TLD versus portfolios. a separate question from the notion of competition between TLDs is how has the introduction of new TLDs affected competition between registrars? To look forward or to think about what the effects of this might be over time, what's the minimum viable scale for a TLD registry? How does the cost structure, fixed versus variable, affect that? And even, in fact, are there registry operators willing to operate their TLD at a loss, even if it's not financially viable, per se? And then we raised a separate question of is a new TLD a valid choice for a registrar if there isn't universal acceptance of the TLD or if the domain name doesn't work consistently, could we still consider that as being a viable choice, or is that harming competition? Another question is, are consumers sufficiently aware to allow for competition? Do they know that these things exist, and is it therefore a reasonable alternative for them? Related to that is who's responsible to promote the TLDs, and even our registrars, as opposed to registrants, aware of the program. And then finally, we have this other question, once again unrelated to the TLD competition question, but are domain names being more effectively allocated, second-level domain names being more effectively allocated to people who would use them for good things, for productive purposes, we'll say, as opposed to, like, speculation and so on. Is that happening more often with the new TLDs than the legacy TLDs? There's a few other things that we didn't quite get to, but those are the high-level headings that we're going to look at and the key questions we're going to try to answer. So obviously, if you're not in this group and you think there's an important question that I haven't enumerated yet, now's the time to let us know. We have a deadline inside our group by March 1st to agree on the set of questions that we're going to investigate. So I guess that roughly applies across the broader group as well, but we'll be more tolerant of last-minute interventions from people not in the group than in the group.
Well, and we might see some changes as a result of the community feedback at America.
So. Certainly our goal would be to make sure that we're asking the right questions for the community to feel like we've done a good job as well.
One thing that's interesting, I think, about this is that we need to make sure that we don't have implicit, where possible, don't have too many implicit assumptions in the way that we're phrasing a question. Like, for example, if we say that domains are used, on that last example you gave, is there greater efficiency in delivering domains to people that would use them well, as opposed to speculation, which might, as a public comment or something, cause some pushback from speculators who think that that's a reasonable, use. So, I mean, we just have to be careful, probably, in terms of, like, talking just about efficiency as opposed to making a value judgment. I don't know, right?
So this is Jordan again. Yeah, no, I agree we shouldn't necessarily that is a value judgment that I made, and we shouldn't necessarily bring that into the review. I do think, and Stan will correct me if I'm wrong, I do think there is a notion of efficient allocation in a lot of, like, auction theory and so on, and that relates to who, whether the person that's getting it is the right person to have the good, and that's roughly, I think, the question we're trying to get at.
Any other questions for the competition team? Okay. Well, so then I think we are probably at the point where we can draw this two-day, our first face-to-face meeting to... Oh. Sorry.
No, you're not done. A few more minutes. What about the structure of the open session with the community? Is there anything we want to... Because we have to... Don't we have to input in the session information what... It's Wednesday afternoon. No, the open one with the community.
It's Wednesday at 5 p.m., I believe.
Yeah, so it's late on Wednesday because we have to post, a session information so that people know what it's all about. So if we could take just a few minutes to kind of see what we think would work. Obviously, it seems to me from what you've been talking about that a public forum type event, is where you're getting information from them, is probably a good place to go. What do you think about sharing these questions as part? Because you don't want to have repeating all the stuff we've already just spent 2 days on. I think you probably want to get information back from them on what's missing, so that you can refine the questions on both of these categories. I mean, anyway, that's my suggestion.
Yeah, and I guess that's what I thought we were already doing. So I apologize. We talked about it briefly earlier. In response to Stan's concern about whether he had any responsibility to the meeting, but I think it's probably makes sense for I don't know the degree to which we cemented David's chairmanship of the other review. There's still some prodding to go there, but maybe a little presentation of each of these sets of thematics, basically, for the group, and then encouraging people to find out where. So I guess I would say to the three of you, potentially, maybe be ready to talk about what those questions are, and then we'll just take a cue, I think, from there, and get people to provide feedback. And I'm really upset about this. I'm really upset about this, and try to our best to incorporate it. I think that's that session. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Come up to the microphone. Jordan, that's a really good set of questions that you've asked there. I'm really impressed with what you've done in such a short period of time. Yeah. Exactly. Is that enough to make a description? Okay.
Yes, that's perfect. Thank you.
Anything else that I'm stepping on that you have an expectation of us figuring out before we... I see a look on Lisa's face.
I'm just thinking, no broader team call before Marrakesh, but the sub-teams may schedule their own calls. That's right.
The sub-teams, I think, are not going to, but we're definitely going to do the Nielsen call. We definitely want to schedule very shortly after we receive that next draft, since that's just coming in
a
couple of days.
Yep.
One more thing, sorry. Okay, so we got the 2 days. We've just talked about the community session. How do we want to break up the 2 days? I mean, do you want to leave it with the sub-teams on how much time they, you know, like, do you want to give the entire Wednesday to sub-teams and, you know, Thursday for combined? Or, you know, I think probably a little bit of planning on how we want to break up the 2 days in Marrakesh.
And I did open that question up for folks and didn't get a big reaction before, and so... What I had said at the time is that Elise and I would maybe put out on the mailing list a straw man for what the structure that might be and get feedback that way. Again, if you do, well, we did say that a substantial proportion will be devoted to that, and so we just need to figure out what else needs to be on that agenda, because it could be almost all of the time could be spent in sub-team work. But.
One other thing to keep in mind, sorry, Carlos, just one second, is... if you wanted to spend maybe more time with Christine Willett on the program implementation review, because she will be there, and I don't know who else from her team might be there, but that's another opportunity to have a face-to-face discussion about that piece of work.
Well, so that's a possibility. I know that we will probably try to come up with the cadences, as Jordan puts it, of what the calls will look like, both for the whole team and for the sub-teams. That will be one of the objectives coming out of Marrakesh, is what that looks like, because it could very well be that the sub-team work will take priority over the group calls in near term, and it's not a question of turning from every other week to every week by doing it, but instead taking allowing the scheduled CCC review call to actually be two sub-team calls instead or something like that in the near term. But you have this very near-term objective of outside research that we want and things like that, and that's the one thing that may affect the schedule for re-engaging on the implementation review, is that based on Stan's suggestion, we're sort of elevating the priority of the first deliverable, if you will, of the sub-teams, which is supplemental reserve research. It has budgetary implications, so that it's just important for us to make a high priority. So that's going to be part of our conversation in Marrakesh, just to kind of nail down what our work plan will be for the next few months, and it may be that it's a de-emphasis of the broader group calls and more of an emphasis on the sub-team calls.
Just a question. I just want to make sure that this is Laureen speaking. Megan, will you please always sit next to me?
Next we'll have voice recognition.
Right, you'll all know. So what Elisa circulated, which I haven't gotten a chance to take a look at, but that's the updated terms of reference, and so we're all going to be looking at that to make sure that that's actually what we all intend to sign on to. Yes, yes?
Agreed.
Okay. Is there a deadline? Should we set a deadline?
I don't know. Our big real deadline right now is Nielsen's. I think we're focused on that. So the deadline's probably before we meet in together in Marrakesh, before the two-day meeting.
Carlos, I want to restate what Elisa just asked. We divided the reading of the 200-page report in four groups, and this is the sub-team of the whole, I guess, and there will be a meeting of the sub-team of the whole so that the groups report on what they read for the benefit of the other ones, and maybe we invite the people from that report. And it would be very useful, in my view, it would be very useful if we use that segment to warm up, like Wednesday morning, and then go into the separate sub-teams.
Carlos, thank you very much. It's a good recommendation, and this is obviously up to the team as a whole. We have to remember this is a marathon and not a sprint, and so what we decided was that the near-term objectives of the sub-teams on competition and on trust were a higher priority from a timing standpoint than the review that we're doing as a whole on the implementation report. So we're effectively absent objection. I mean, if everybody feels like they're not overworked, we can try to do those things in parallel, right? But I think absent objection, we're hitting pause on that. We've identified teams, read it on your own time, et cetera, and then once the sub-teams have delivered the recommendations for supplementary research, we'll go back and re-engage full steam on the implementation review portion of the application process portion of the review. Does that make sense? Okay, so that was the decision we made, I made as an assumption, but if anybody objects to that, there's no point in burning everybody out in the first month of the review team. That's right. Sorry, is that all you were asking? I'm sorry.
Yeah, hey, John, it's Jordan. I think that plan makes a lot of sense because I think if both groups are intending to identify a bunch of research that needs to be done, we'll actually naturally get to a pause in those two sub-teams while we sort of wait for research to happen. And during that time, seems like it would make perfect sense to slot back in and do the application analysis. Then we'll have a bunch of data that we can go back to in the sub-teams again. So I think that as a rough sequence seems to make a lot of sense with me. And I would certainly rather members of my sub-team spend the next 2 weeks figuring out what the key research topics are as opposed to reading the implementation review.
All agreed. Any other questions? All right. So I'm just looking over here at staff to see if they're going to be like, no, 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 again. So did everybody respond on whether they're going to dinner via the invitation? That's the last logistical.
It's not canceled. That was a mistake. It's still at 6:30, safe restaurant.
Carlos asked whether or not we need to re-sign the statement of interest, and we will, in fact, eventually need to do that, but it is pending finalization of this conflict of interest policy because it's referenced in that document. So in other words, we're not handing them out now because we still had some feedback on
I will research
family rights
was
the issue. And, the answer is just the definition of family, right? All right, so I think that's everything. Thank you all so much. I feel like this was a great 2 days. I really appreciate it. When the team was first announced, I'm sure everybody looked at who everybody else was and wondered, you know, how it was going to go, who was going to be a good contributor, who was going to be quiet, was anybody going to be stooging for, you know, the ICANN organization, And the truth is that it's my opinion, everybody did a phenomenal job, and I want you all to give yourselves a round of applause. So thanks. Thank you so much.
And we should
should add a special thank you to the chairs, sub-chairs, and sub-sub-sub-chairs, and all the others, and the ICANN staff. Thank you.
Oh, yeah.
And also the people who joined remotely at odd hours, bad hours.
Oh, yeah, thanks for doing it.
And Calvin, yeah.
So the dinner's canceled. Is that what I just saw? Oh.